6:30 by my clock, and we want to welcome you to the Community Impact Board meeting of December 10th, 2020. Glad to have you all with us again electronically. We all look forward to the day when we can meet in person. Really miss that interaction, but we're keeping the business going and appreciate everybody accommodating this meeting electronically, including our applicants and those who are attending to listen in from the public. I'm going to turn some time over to Candace for the financial review and any other items for the board. Candace.
Good morning, all of you. I didn't get a chance to say good morning to you, each of you personally, but I can see you, and I appreciate that your attendance and your service. As Jonathan said, this is December 10th, 2020. It's the actually the first review meeting that we've had for the second trimester of fiscal year 2021. There are six projects and one large infrastructure application to be discussed at today's meeting. Projects will be placed on the priority list today as suggested by the board, the funding that the board authorizes. Final funding will be authorized at the February 4th, 2021 CIB funding meeting. The application form allows the applicant to request a funding package, so you will see those that are indicated on what you see on your screen. That's the financials. That's what the applicant has requested. You will note that there's a lot of grant there, and understandably so from an applicant's point of view. But as you scroll down, Brenda, to the actuals, when those types of funding awards are allocated with the available revenue that CIB has right now, it does compromise the mineral lease balance quite a bit. It puts it in the red right now. We've gotten some loan payments back. And thank you for updating that, Brenda. As of Tuesday, it was $8 million in the hole. We are now $4 million. So we still need some work to do. But remember, this is as of today's revenue by February, which is why the board does not fund anything at these three review meetings. By February, there will be a different mineral lease revenue to work with, and we may look, and hopefully will look, a little more healthy. But there is adequate funding in the bonus balance, even if we fund everything. And this is, remember, as the applicant has requested. Going forward, this financial sheet will have the numbers that are the median tool funding allocations. So you'll get a little better look at what the tool enables the fund to look like. It will be the median, remember. We have a minimum and we have a maximum, but the median will be placed on this sheet for the next meeting, except for those that we discussed today. Those we discussed today will be put on this sheet as the board moves it forward to the prioritization list. The bonus fund is healthy, like I said. As a reminder to those listening, the bonus fund must be allocated as a loan and bear an interest rate. The board is tasked with keeping the funds revolving. So for a while now, the revenue is coming in from historical loans. Keep that in mind. The board, when they authorize even 0% loans, 0% loans will always come out of the mineral lease account, not the bonus, because the bonus must bear an interest. So that's what I have. Usually I say, please sign in, but I'm just going to forego that because it's difficult for you to do. But you have signed in through Zoom, so welcome.
We have a question from Commissioner Lytle.
Okay.
Thank you, Candace, for your report. Will we see both of those on the next report, what the tool provides as the median as well as the requested? so we can see the difference?
On the review sheet that you see for each individual applicant, that's always what they request. You'll see their requested amount.
Yeah, yeah.
But on the financial sheet, we will utilize the tools numbers to better understand, because the board is tasked with being a little more consistent and utilize that tool. Of course, hopefully utilizing their humanity to do what needs to be done for various projects. But
in summary, it's, and maybe it can be an offline conversation, it seems like it might be good to see both what the requests, the total of the requests as requested on the other sheet. I realize that we'll have the one that
we can have two numbers.
Yes.
For the balances. But
maybe I'm misunderstanding. I guess I'm asking to see.
No,
what,
you want to compare them.
I want to be able to see both what the tool, what the median on the tool recommends, as well as what they're asking for, especially if it's different than the tool. Not individually, but the sum.
We can do the sum.
Presented. Yeah. Just that's at least for discussion's sake. Maybe I'm not understanding it completely.
No, I understand what you want.
Definitely doable. Okay, let's go to Mr. Stevens.
I had a curiosity question. I didn't know if this was on the agenda. I didn't see it anywhere, but wondered with the repayments, how many entities have requested the COVID deferral, I guess, based on what we had, the fact that we passed that policy in the past.
Yeah, the policy that the board passed allowed a COVID deferral of up to two years if it was directly related to the COVID emergency. And the board authorized 120 days past when there is no longer an emergency. That being said, we still only have one that actually moved through the process, and that's still Canyonlands. I have received no more applications, but with the coming year and new loan payments due, we'll see. But there aren't any more right now.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Galecki.
Hi, real quick, to the staff, Candace, I appreciate the on the projects, how it's pretty clear of what they want and then, you know, what the median range is. So those are two good markers on the individual sheets. So that's good. My question, and I guess it's a little bit answered just now by Kyle, but, you know, like how it dropped, you know, we had $4 million come into the funds this week. Do you have a sense, or could the staff project each month, like how much is anticipated to be in the balance by the time?
We can get close. It depends on how quickly the numbers that come in are actuated into our balance by the finance team and loan payments. So I can tell you that the mineral lease revenue that came in for the month of November was about $1,600,000. So that didn't make up all of this difference. So it's hard to project to see what the balance will, you know, to project to February. That's why we need to watch this and kind of work the numbers we have. There will be loan repayments, and also Brenda Brown has been going through and reviewing old accounts and making sure that the projects are completed and then closing those out. And that fund comes back into the mineral lease balance as well. So those are two actions that have affected this $4 million less mineral lease deficit. So in regard to your question, we'll project as best we can, which is what this sheet does, but it's both the revenue that's coming in, and we can kind of tell that we're going to get between $1 million and $1.5 million each month, which is definitely reduced from 3 years ago. But, and with that in mind, we'll do this, but there will also be loans. We've had Zions Bank refund a couple of our loans. That funding will be coming back in as well, because they paid off our bond and did two of them. They were big. And you will see more in January about how that affected this balance. So we'll do the best we can to give you a very updated and current amount for the board to work with.
Thank you.
So, Greg, I've got a great project in mind. I think that's going to get to where you're at. It's just scheduling out all our outstanding loans and when we expect those payments to come in, so that we have a more accurate picture of what the future looks like. We can't always predict when our loans are going to get paid off, but we can at least schedule out the revenue that comes in on the repayment side. That is a project we'll be working on. I haven't talked to any of my staff about this yet, but I'm going to get somebody assigned to do that and schedule it out.
But that would at least give us the conservative revenue.
Yeah, and it's going to also show as we make funding decisions, and like Candace noted, we have much less revenue on repayments coming back into Mineral Lease than we used to, because so much of it has gone out as grants. So it's going to show how our decision making is impacting the permanency of the mineral lease account. But that is something we want to make sure is a little more available and transparent to the board for the consideration. Okay, no more further questions on that. I think I need to read a statement here, since we don't have an anchor location. So I'm going to read the statement that I signed. Before we go to a roll call of who's here. I, Jonathan Hardy, Chairman of the Permanent Community Impact Board, have determined that the December 10th, 2020 meeting of the Permanent Community Impact Board will be held electronically without an anchor location. This determination is based on the following facts. One, Utah is currently dealing with COVID-19, which has been determined to be a pandemic. COVID-19 is extremely contagious and can be deadly to those who contract it, especially those of advanced age and underlying health conditions. Two, the agency offices are in Salt Lake County, which has been identified as a county with a high level of transmission. This designation requires wearing a mask and strongly recommends physical distancing. Three, a vast majority of agency staff and the members of the board/commission are teleworking to avoid unnecessary contact with others. Four, the board room is insufficient to allow social distancing and reasonably safe accommodation of the commission and the public. Five, the commission uses an electronic platform which allows interested parties to view the meeting and hear discussions, dated the 7th day of December 2020. So that's our Open and Public Meetings Act statement that I've got to get out on the table. Let's do a roll call of board members present. Pam, if you could do that, please.
I will. Treasurer Damshin, are you on with us yet? Okay. Mr. Galecki.
Greg?
Here.
Thank you. Commissioner Ogden.
Here.
Commissioner Lytle.
Here.
Mayor Baker.
Here.
Mr. Stevens.
Here.
Commissioner Dalton?
Present.
Thank you. Commissioner Hansen?
Present.
Commissioner Adams?
I'm here.
And Mr. Zanotti?
Here.
All present, with the exception of the treasurer, who will be coming later.
Okay. Chair rules. We have a quorum present, ready to conduct business. We have the minutes before us of November 5th, 2020. Would entertain a motion on the minutes.
So moved.
Motion from Mr. Zanotti and a second from Commissioner Ogden to approve the minutes of November 5th, 2020. Further discussion? Yeah, let's do a voice vote on this. All in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed?
This is Greg. I abstained. I wasn't there.
Okay, so all in the affirmative. Mr. Galecki abstaining from the vote. The minutes are approved. We wanted to have a discussion right now. One of the follow-up items from our November meeting, which was solely focused on the audit recommendations, making sure we had covered every item there, was to have to invite state purchasing to join us. One of our policies that is kind of in place to kick in January 1 is one of the audit recommendations was to consider having a threshold that communities had to use state purchasing over a certain dollar amount. Right now, our policy says as of January 1, that will be $1 million. Any project over $1 million would need to utilize state purchasing. We had a number of questions that came up, and so our follow-up was to invite purchasing with us. We have Chris Hughes joining us. I don't know if you have anybody else on staff here with us, but we wanted to get a sense of the purchasing process, how to utilize state purchasing if you're a community out there. Is $1 million a reasonable threshold? I know I've gotten a lot of feedback on this particular issue. Not everybody likes this recommendation, and we've heard it in our board discussion. I've heard it with other stakeholders. But we want to have a frank discussion about this policy, where it sits. So, Chris, maybe I can just turn a few minutes over to you to introduce yourself and what you can provide, and then maybe we'll just have a discussion with the board here on any outstanding questions that we may have.
Right. So my name's Chris Hughes. I'm the Director for Purchasing and General Services for the state of Utah. In that role, I oversee a few things for the state. The first one is that I help all executive branch agencies go through the procurement process for any purchase going over $5,000. We handle about 1,300 procurements a year for the executive branch agencies on those. In addition, we enter into what are called cooperative contracts for the state of Utah. These cooperative contracts are contracts commonly used by all public entities and nonprofits in the state of Utah. These contracts are used by over 500 public entities and nonprofits in the state of Utah to over about $750 million each year. These contracts are easy to use and are available for any public entity to use. In addition, we provide a resource to any public entity that needs assistance with the procurement process. We help over 100 public entities a year that are not under my authority that need assistance. So if a public entity doesn't have a purchasing agent or needs to go out to buy something and doesn't know what to do, they can enter into an agreement with my office for my office to handle the procurement process for them. That procurement process is free of charge. We don't ever charge for any of our services for the public entities that need assistance. But over the last year, we've posted nearly 200 of these courtesy postings on behalf of public entities. And the services that we offer under these courtesy postings range from just publishing the solicitation on our website so that public notice is provided to providing a normal service that we would to an executive branch agency, meaning that we would meet with you, talk with you about your procurement, see what the problem is, and help you write out the solicitation. So I'm pretty familiar with a lot of your public entities. I would say some of your public entities purchase or use our cooperative contracts. And then some of you have used our services in the past to get your solicitations posted. But in regards to what sounds like anything over $1 million, my division would be happy to help to whatever extent you needed our help and whatever assistance you needed it to be. And with that, I'll take any questions or comments, or some of you may want to throw out complaints, but I'm happy to hear those as well.
always a brave man to welcome complaints. Let's go to questions from the board. I know several board members have brought up this particular requirement a lot, and since they represent a lot of these local communities. Let's go to Commissioner Ogden first.
Well, Chris is a brave man for getting on here. I have had a discussion with Chris and also with Treasurer Dampson. And I guess my question is for you, Chris, how boggled down is this going to make the, you know, we don't want to make this this application process, what would I say, bog the process down by having to go through a state purchasing?
That's a good question. And what I tell a lot of people is when we look at the data of what state purchasing does compared to what may be done before it even gets to us, is sometimes that process before it gets to us is the lengthier process. And then by the time any procurement runs through my office, they're wanting it done yesterday. So what we try and encourage executive branch agencies and any agency that's going to use my services is to engage with us at the very beginning so that we can be a part of what's going on and that we can provide suggestions to you on what may help speed up the procurement process in that sense, I know a lot of we've had procurements here in the state that the agencies try to work on for 18 months without engaging state purchasing. And then when they engage us, they want it done within 2 weeks. And those seem to be very complicated, and we try and work with them extensively and put a lot of hours into it. But that would be one thing that I would say is if this process does go through, engage with us early on so we know what to expect and how to expect it so that we can plan accordingly as well. And then it seems to be a smooth process.
Okay, a follow-up question, I guess, for Chairman Hardy. Is this in our audit, was that a recommendation, or was this going to be a required thing? And most of these projects or cities, a lot of them are pretty well vetted anyway. I guess that brings up the next part of that equation.
Yeah, so I'm going to read the recommendation itself. If I can find it here easily. I have the audit report pulled up this morning. All right. It says that we should consider a threshold of requiring state purchasing be utilized. Now, I think a good question for Chris is, what does that mean to have state purchasing be utilized? You recommended a bunch of services. I mean, what could be, it sounded like it could be as simple as you just post the notice and can a community still run the procurement or select the winning bid? Is that still working with state purchasing if you just run the notice?
So can I ask, who did the audit come from? Did it come from the state auditor or somebody else?
It came from the legislative auditors. Here's what it says. Let me read it real quick. We recommend that the Permanent Community Impact Board consider requiring that state purchasing be used with larger projects and determine a threshold for imposing this requirement. So told us to consider it, and we've obviously had a lot of conversation about it and talked about that $1 million threshold, but that's what it says, Chris.
Yeah, and I would say that you're right. It sounds like just engaging us at any point. It doesn't mean that we have to run the whole process for you. If your city, county, whoever it may be that's going through this already has that established, they may already have established procurement guidelines outside of the Utah Procurement Code, which is allowed under state law. So by engaging us, it may just mean that we do one of our normal services of just posting the solicitation on your behalf, or it may mean that you just want us to do a quick review of it to see if anything's missing in terms of a public procurement. And if you are following your city or county's guidelines for procurement, we would just kind of do a high-level review of making sure that it looks to be competitive and nothing more. In terms of how I read that, it sounds like you get to really identify if and at what to what extent you want us involved. And that's something that we commonly go through with other cities and counties as we help them with their solicitations.
All right. Mayor Baker.
Yes, I was just going to bring up that question that I had about professional services and what does the state procurement do? Do they help with professional services, or is it more of actual purchasing of an inventory or something like that?
We can help with the procurement of professional services or any type of service. As you can imagine, at the state level, we handle a wide variety of different procurements. So we're happy to help with whatever we need. And chances are we've done a solicitation or have seen a solicitation similar to what you're requesting.
Okay. That one of my questions is we have engineering firms that are very familiar out in each little area of the state, that if you had just a general list and was required to go through that and select the lowest bidder, it's a lot of times they don't understand, and they could be somebody on the Wasatch Front that's never been out to Naples, you know, whatever type thing. And I don't have a problem with you guys helping to post on there, but I don't think the state auditor or the legislative auditors quite understood what you guys all do, what your progress is. So I think that's some of the confusion there too.
Yeah, and for sure is we never look at any procurement and say the low bid absolutely has to be at every time. When you're talking about engineers, that's part 15 of the procurement code, where you look at reviewing applications and then selecting the vendor you believe is most qualified and then entering into cost negotiations with them to provide that service. So price isn't even discussed until you select the vendor that's most qualified.
Okay. Thank you for your comments.
Commissioner Lytle.
Sorry, it took a sec to get unmuted. Thank you, sir, for coming and speaking to us. Thank you, Chairman, for having him come. I've got a few questions and comments. Mm-hmm. You spoke about the general oversight or review, if you're requested to do that, to make sure that it falls within, I assume, one, that their procurement code, if it's a town or a county or whatever entity it is, you're reviewing that. If asked, you could review that and review what they've done for the particular project to know that they're within their procurement policies or procedures, and that their procedures are within the state guidelines. That's what I heard, and I'll finish up with that one. Did I hear you correctly? I guess is what I want to know.
So no, we want to, if we're doing a review, we don't go in and look at your code and rule or regarding procurement and say whether it's wrong or whether it needs to be modified. We believe that that's within your authority to determine what your procurement processes are. What we would look at is just to make sure that it did appear to be adequate and that you weren't, or competitive and that you weren't naming a vendor in the solicitation. We would also look at just to make sure that it is following best practices of procurement. I've worked with the state auditor in reviewing the number of county and city procurement code guidelines or procurement guidelines.
Right.
And we never go in and say you need to follow the Utah procurement code. That's one thing I stress with the state auditor, is that we just make sure that there's nothing in that guideline that can make it appear as though you can just go back and pick whoever you want at the end of the process. I think that's the number one concern we always have. But ultimately, it's up to your control.
Could you go sole source gets tricky.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody sees the need, could they ask you to review their sole source justifications as it relates to best practices and those things to see if to have that backup or not? If
yeah, absolutely. We do a lot of sole source reviews where we do run information through a database just to see if there is others that can provide that similar source and look at the justification. And we do look at the procurement code on that as well, just to say, hey, look, we don't, if somebody's been working on a project for 10 years and it just needs another few years to fix it up, we probably want to sole source that to that vendor that's already been working on that.
In the interest of the vendor and the project.
Yeah. Yeah. What we look for is just to make sure that everybody's protected on the back end, that it's not going to come back through another audit.
Right. Can I make the next step to, we're told or we've experienced at times, and maybe it's more, I think it would have to come through you as well, but DOT in particular, at times they'll do a request for a list of qualified professionals to where they can use that list as part of the process where they may do an RFQ or RFP. And in terms of trying to pick best qualified professionals, engineers in particular, and we certainly get exposed to some of the with the engineers in our efforts.
Hey, you're listening to this conversation, aren't you?
Yeah.
Do you think it's going to be just another?
I think we better tell.
I muted him.
Oh, somebody did? Okay. So back to the list of qualified professionals, I know for different, like say we're looking for airport or road construction stuff. I don't know if it's straight through DOT, but it helps shorten the effort if we don't have to run our own RFQ, that there's already been one done. And I may have misstated it as RFQ, but that there's already been a discernment process. And really all you have to do is pick one of the ones that have already been through that discernment process and then start dealing with the cost.
Yeah. That,
go ahead.
I was going to say, yeah, when that goes through DOT, that they handle that on their own, but that is something that we look to set up for a lot of procurements in the state is just to get a list that people can go back and pick from. Then the only thing we look at when we have a list like that is to make sure that the list is actually being used and that it's not just going back and picking your favored vendor over and over and over again.
Correct.
So we would work with DOC to make sure that list is up to date and using that the ability to use that list is adequate for what's being requested.
So even as counties, sometimes we'll go through, if we know we've got a number of projects coming up of a similar ilk, go through an RFP process or RFQ, something that goes through a discernment process for qualifications. And then as the projects come up, we've already done the pre-work and we can start picking from that group depending on their qualifications. But they've already been through that filtering process, I guess you could say, or discernment process to establish their ability to be on the list, as well as a timetable that it's good for a year or 2 years and then reevaluate again after that. Is that fit into best practices? I know there's a lot of details that.
Yeah, that generally fits into best practices. It would be what we call an approved vendor list is something
that you
look at every 18 months. As long as you're reviewing their qualifications, that's something that we look at.
And then is there a way do you guys have approved vendor lists that we can utilize?
We do have approved vendor lists you can utilize. We have approved vendors and different contracts already established that you could utilize. And if we needed to set up different approved vendor lists based off of different projects that come out of this group, we would be happy to do that as well and to manage that group.
Have you found there's been any problems? Sometimes once that contract's made with the state, when we've gone to the approved vendor list and looked at it, and then sometimes we've, we've been able to do better than the approved vendor list or state contracts, either because of locality or any number of issues that make it different.
Yeah.
And that's where I think some of the worry has come, is that if we get, if we start telling people they have to use that approved vendor list or they have to use state contracts, they come back and say, but we can do it cheaper here. Assuming you're comparing apples and apples, oranges and oranges. Sometimes I realize that that can become a nuanced effort.
Right. And I'm not saying to you would have to use our list or anything like that. We would hope to work with you to be able to get the locality issue. That's one issue that I believe needs to be really worked on here, just because of the geography of Utah, is being able to get more local vendors on contracts for all cities and counties. It's something that I'm committed to, is to get more involvement in local companies. And yeah, as we tell our vendors, even on state contract, we understand that's your price to publish, but if you even call up the vendor and just ask them what their price is based off of your project, chances are they're going to lower it, just because they know what the project is at that point and they can actually identify what they'll need to do moving forward.
Thank you very much. That's, for the moment anyway, that takes care of me, Chairman.
Okay, Mr. Galecki.
I know our conversations are kind of at the 10,000 foot level, but I guess for Chris, my question is going to be towards, you know, kind of workload and process. You know, we probably have, let's say it was $1 million, we probably have, I'm going to say close to a dozen applications that would be, you know, that would come to you on a quarterly basis. Would you be able to handle that workload? And that's part of the question. And the next one is, I see the process. You know how you said you wanted to be involved early on from the process. Do you see needing, and I guess this is a little bit for Candace, or, you know, throwing it out there, would there, if you were involved at a certain level, would they need your, you know, concurrence or moving forward? Or, you know, they live there and if you didn't have it on, they press on? You're on both, and I'm just looking at the process. Wondering, if you can handle the workload, and the other is, what happens if you can't?
So, yes, I'm not worried about my office handling the workload of any amount. My staff is capable of handling that workload. To that point of, if we weren't involved early on, would that create problems? No, you guys can do what you need to do, and this group runs. It would just be a matter of getting us what the solicitation needed to be at that point, if it just needed to be posted. The process, absolutely, we would really want to work on that to hold each of us accountable. If this is what we wanted to do, is to create a process where you knew what to do, I knew what to do, and we could move forward in that arrangement, and that if either one of us was failing, we would know who was the accountable party. This is what we set up with a lot of our executive branch agencies as well, as kind of the service level agreement, so that each party knows their accountability and kind of what to do for each situation.
Hold on, Commissioner. We've got several in the queue here. and I think what it's sort of sounding like is, I think one of the concerns brought up by board members and stakeholders, they were worried that state purchasing was now going to make the decision on who was going to win bids. And there was some concern about that. And it sounds to me like utilizing state purchasing does not necessarily connotate state purchasing making the decision on procurements.
Right. And I'll clarify that, is we help the solicitations go through the procurement process. Any evaluation or determination of whether a vendor is qualified or not qualified comes from the stakeholder. We get that a lot in the news, is that state purchasing decided to go with X vendor after a request for proposals process. In a request for proposals process, it is actually the agency doing all of the evaluation on the proposals and not state purchasing. State purchasing will be involved just to make sure that the evaluation team is not steering to a preferred vendor, but all of the scores and all of the evaluation is coming in from the agency themselves. So my role isn't to tell you who the best vendor is. My role in any public procurement is to ensure that it goes through the process, that it's a competitive process, that it's being transparent with everybody, and that it's being fair. And that's where what my office does, not select the vendors.
Let's go. Candace, you had a comment?
Just a comment, and this is mostly for the benefit of Chris, but the board, to remind them. The board authorized that the state procurement code is the code that all applicants are required to abide by. So if they were to submit through state purchasing, that review done by state purchasing to make sure their RFQs or RFPs would follow state procurement would be great. Because I don't think that they're clear, but CIB through the audit has decided to require the state procurement code to be utilized. So I'm just reminding everybody that is a requirement now, according to the board, for all projects. I was waiting for somebody to bring that up, but they didn't.
Thank you. That is important to establish the process on what would need to occur.
Let's go to Treasurer Damshin.
I have a professional history with formal procurement longer and deeper than I would wish to have. During my 20 years in the banking industry, I was on the responding side to very complex RFPs from Starbucks and Novell for treasury and banking services. I watched Novell ask every technical question under the sun using a template called the Association for Financial Professionals RFP template that got into excruciating detail on treasury technology, things like electronic data interchange, wholesale lockbox, controlled disbursement. They took these templates and just asked every question, thinking, I guess, that they would get a great education from the responses. They received, our response was I think 2-3 ring binders, and they got that from like 14 banks, and they had so much information they didn't know how to do anything with it. So, and they had told us before the procurement they were looking to change what they were doing, but they worked themselves into a corner not understanding how to, intelligently administer procurement and not ask questions you don't have to have the answers to. Worked on a lot of things like that over the years on the responding side, and I've been in the treasurer's office for 11 years now, and we're responsible for two separate state agencies. Lots of procurements across the spectrum, large and small. I just wanted to throw in a couple of additional perspectives. I do work with a lot of state agencies on payment technology and treasury and banking initiatives around the state, and I will tell you there are cultural differences among state agencies. I suspect a lot of our board members see that too, because you're working with different state agencies, and some of them are have very, very good culture, some not so much. I just wanted to point out workforce services. This is where we live in the CIB. Workforce services has by far one of the best cultures of all state agencies. I'm not just saying that because our wonderful staff is on the line and they work in workforce services, but workforce services is tasked with so many things. They're very technology centric, technology forward, and they've been wonderful to work with. So I have distinct ideas in my mind about different state agencies and which ones are really great to work with and ones not so much. And I will never mention the names of the not so much agencies. But I want to tell you that purchasing division is another one of those agencies that has an incredibly positive culture. They're very consultative, and what you're hearing from Chris is typical of the folks that work in his agency. We go to Chris and the folks that work in his agency, and we say, here's what we're trying to achieve. And we, through our procurements, have a lot of the same concerns that you all have. We'll say, you know, we don't want to get cornered into the lowest bidder. We have a lot of, I wanted to go back to Mayor Baker's question. When Chris answered, yeah, we can do professional services procurements, I think that radically understated the fact that purchasing division gets deeply involved in an incredibly broad spectrum of services procurements. They're not just about paper clips and printing paper and stuff like that. They get involved in all kinds of things, large and small. I think most board members are probably aware that one of the distinct advantages of consulting with purchasing division is the state does enter into statewide cooperative contracts, which take the purchasing power of the state at large. And these aren't contracts that local governments are required to use, but we've worked on a number of them over the years. Most significantly, the one that you would probably most readily recognize is for credit card processing. If you're going to accept and receive credit cards for certain things, we take the $1 billion in payments a year of the state's payment processing to the marketplace and receive pricing and bids based on that kind of buying power. That can have great that can have great value to local governments, but local governments are not required to tie onto those contracts. But I just kind of wanted to say, you know, we've been in the trenches with purchasing division on so many things over the years across a broad spectrum where we had what we felt were unique needs, where we had situations that we thought were sole source or similar to sole source. And we had sensitivities that very similar to what you're expressing, Commissioner Vital. And they're a good partner. That's how I think of them. And they work very consultatively. And I think it's good to be skeptical about government. And I think it's okay to be leery and to be concerned about the potential for bureaucracy and kind of potential for overreach on the part of state government. But I just wanted to say, you know, in the many, many dealings I've had with purchasing division, they've just been so helpful to us to come out on top with the best possible outcome. They know how to get to that point and to do it legally and with best practices. And they see it all. You know, Chris and his folks, they, like I said, they're dealing with such a broad spectrum of scenarios, serving agencies and consulting on the things that they do already. I see a huge upside here. I know it's a little uncomfortable to be compelled through the outcome of an audit in a direction like this if you feel like it's not going to be beneficial ultimately to the work that CIB does, but I think that it would be ultimately beneficial. And I think that in putting an arrangement together going forward, there's room for, I guess, negotiation in terms of how this all works most effectively. Most of the interactions can be facilitated through CIB staff in certain ways just to make sure that we're not incurring too much brain damage at the local level with these projects. So those are just my two cents. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So we've got four people in the queue here, and I'm going to cut it off there. I think ultimately what we're really talking about is when we say utilize state purchasing, we need to come back and really say, what does that entail? And we can work with Chris on coming back with some more specifics at our next board meeting on what that looks like. Even though it's effective January 1, we're not funding, our funding meeting is not till February, so we have some time to kind of iron out this process. So I really appreciate a lot of the dialogue so far. So we're going to go. Oh, good. One person dropped off. So we'll go Commissioner Dalton, Mayor Baker, and then Commissioner Lytle on the topic.
Okay. Very quickly, in the interest of time, I understand what Treasurer Dampson has said and what you're saying, but I think we're taking away, unless it's a guideline, not a requirement, taking away the local entities ability to procure their own procurement process And if they don't do it right, then they're going to be subject to state law. I mean, they have to do certain things, and we're taking, if we make it a requirement, we're taking that ability away from them to do their own thing that they're elected or appointed to do within their own communities. And I realize the state government policy or procedure is a good one, but we have, specifically in Beaver County, we have beat the price of the state procurement contracts in different things, and I just don't want it to be a requirement that they have to go with the state. And I think that's been stated, and I apologize for bringing that back up, but I think it needs to be more of a guideline. If you run into problems, the state procurement office is readily available to help, but it's not a requirement that every project has to be ran through the state procurement process.
Chris, do you want to comment on that? I mean, I think our intent, so kind of what I'm hearing on the dialogue today, is your concern can probably still be addressed even with our requirement. I mean, we're still saying that the entity can follow their procurement code. We may be talking about publishing every project over $1 million on the state purchasing website and doing some review just to make sure that it's the procurement process they are following is, you know, transparent or there's nothing missing there. It sounds to me like we could still operate with the local entities controlling the procurement process. Am I wrong, Chris? Is that
something? No, I would want them to control the procurement process. I would want them to be the leaders of it. There's nothing that I can come in and say that I'm the expert in the project that you're going to be working on. In fact, I don't sell myself as the expert on anything. Is if my people were to be involved, my people would be driving down to Kane County, Beaver County, wherever they needed to go to learn from you what you were looking for. They're not just going to get on the phone. They're not just going to publish whatever you want. I send my people throughout the state frequently. I hear these concerns frequently, and we do review them on an ongoing basis. But as we've learned to work, I would say that one of the best thing that Utah has for us in any aspect compared to other states is exactly what's going on this phone call right now, is that everybody's willing to help anybody else and willing to set aside their time to meet and to discuss these issues and to provide any sort of service. That's really what, as I go around the nation and talk to other states, that's what they miss. Their school districts won't even talk to each other. Their cities won't even talk to each other when it comes to procurements. But here in Utah, for whatever reason, we're very unique in doing this sort of item. And we're very unique in wanting to help each other and to give each other support. But let the individual entity do what it needs to do to get it done. And that's all, from what I understand, my role would be is to just be a support, not to provide any requirements, not to provide any additional processes or procedures, but to be there to ensure that it does go through a competitive, fair, and transparent process for those over $1 million, and to be there for any other help. Absolutely, I want to be involved more with local governments and local entities just to provide support, because I know procurement just never is the profession anybody wants to go into, and it's hard to find people to do that stuff because it does create a lot of headaches and a lot of problems. But we are here to support you in what you're doing, and don't think we're taking away any of your power just because we're the state government. Is we have a culture of listening and a culture of problem solving here at State Purchasing. And I'm proud of what my employees do for non-executive branch agencies as we help them on a daily basis as well.
Mayor Baker.
Okay, just two quick questions, Chairman, and I appreciate all the comments that have been made, and it's got me a little, just maybe I can ask these two questions, get a little clarification. So one is, after proposals are received by state purchasing, Does the state purchasing help select, or is the decision still the local entities?
The decision is always the entity requesting the item. So state purchasing does a review of the proposals to make sure that they provide the information that's been requested. And then every proposal goes back down to the agency that's reviewing to review. And state purchasing may say, hey, you asked this question. This vendor did not answer this question, just as an FYI. But the evaluation and the selection goes back to the agency.
Okay. And then appreciate that, Chris, because that's what I was concerned with. And my other question is, following state procurement, is that different than using state purchasing? If we follow state procurement code, is that different than using state purchasing? Or are they separate, or are they combined?
No, some public that they are separate. If the procurement, the Utah procurement code is out there for any public entity to use, some public entities adopt it. Some local government entities adopt it. Others adopt their own. I think it's split on what everybody does. If you adopt the Utah procurement code, you are not required to use state purchasing. We are there as a resource, but you are not required to use us.
So I guess the question is, what we've approved, Chairman, was that we will use state purchasing, or that we will follow state procurement?
So that all entities are required to follow the state procurement code, which is, you know, most of our projects that it just requires that they do a competitive bid. That's what the state procurement code is going to say. Anything over a certain threshold, you know, under, you can probably get three bids and do it, but none of our projects are really in that size. But the extra requirement we kind of have out there is if you have $1 million project or more, that you would have to use state purchasing. That's the requirement. Everything else is still kind of, you just need to follow the procurement code, which is you need to put out a competitive bid. What we're saying is if it's $1 million or more, you need to use state purchasing to do that bid process. But I think there's also, it sounds like, some room on defining what does using state purchasing mean for that, over that $1 million. So that's kind of why I'm suggesting we could maybe come back with some more specifics in our policy about what that looks like to give some more clarity for your communities to understand, you know, is it a technical assistance process, which is really what we're talking about here, or, you know, how involved is that process with the state, with state purchasing?
And if you want, I would be happy to draft out a process map that what you guys could look at and say, hey, this works, this doesn't work, so you can see exactly where state purchasing is involved, where you're involved, and state purchasing's real role. I know I've only been the chief procurement officer for 3 years at the state, and I know when I came in, there was a lot of misconceptions, and I mean misconceptions that were 20 years old, that I needed to go find, when somebody would bring up something, I had to go find the Utah code from 1993 to figure out what they were talking about. We have rewritten the Utah procurement code over the last 2 years, and this wasn't just my office rewriting it. I sent out emails to every city, every county, received thousands of responses of what we could change, had submissions in from some of your people saying this is what we do and we like, and we adopted some of those things. So the Utah code and the Utah procurement code has changed substantially on what you can and cannot do. It's, I believe it's one of the most flexible codes in the nation in reviewing every procurement code that's out there. I would just, when I come in and I talk to people, I use the example of there's a restaurant on State Street in Salt Lake, and it's got the sign up that says, come on in and you'll be pleasantly surprised. I just say, give me that ability to provide a service to you, and I think you'll be pleasantly surprised of what we actually do compared to maybe what you've heard we do at state purchasing or what you've heard others say we do. I've over the last 3 years have traveled throughout the state and have worked with thousands of people, just understanding and helping them out outside of the executive branch. And I'm happy to do this for you and help you write out a process map of what my expectations would be. And then we can go from there.
All right, let's go to Commissioner Lytle, and then we'll wrap up this discussion.
This has been hugely helpful, and thank you, Chris. And the questions that Commissioner Baker asked, I thought were helpful in helping define some of the issues. I want to thank Treasurer Damchin for his statements, and I concur. I think you boiled it down, Chairman. What does used state purchasing mean? And in this conversation, what came to mind for me, it's at least a review and a consult at a minimum effort. If I heard you right, Chris, it could be more, but at a minimum, it's a review and consult when it comes to state purchasing so that entity that's required to use state purchasing, to me, that's the minimum that review and consult process. Mostly what it does is helps protect the public's money in an effort to backstop it with best practices. And that connection to the procurement code, obviously there's, and I can speak, if I recall correctly, if we haven't adopted all of it, we've certainly adopted many parts of the state procurement code as our code, because those definitions, why reinvent the wheel? When it comes to sole source and different things, they're well defined. Yes, there's always questions, as the treasurer brought up, and unique things with each project that you, sometimes it takes another eye to look at it to say, okay, yeah, you do have a problem, or you do have a challenging question to ask and work through, or no, we deal with this all the time and here's some solutions. And then it's still up to the entity to make some choices. And currently still a state employee, certainly on the low end of the totem pole when it comes to purchasing stuff in my current position, but in previous positions, with the state, obviously you get what you ask. And if you come in with a good attitude that there's an opportunity to work this out with people that deal with it, or it can be a pleasant effort, maybe not without effort, but if you come in saying, oh no, here's one more thing to check off and I got to do this and I got to do that, without recognizing the value of what CIB is asking right now, I think it gets back to what the treasurer was talking about with culture. And if we can bring this as a positive effort, it helps protect those entities in the long run. When it comes to getting the best product, getting the best use of the dollars that we allocate, I see the wisdom in the effort. The one question that comes up to me so that we can answer some is, depending on the effort that we want to define use state purchasing, how much time, I mean, are we looking at a minimum of a week anytime we want to tie in with you, Chris, to even if it's as simple as the review and consult, before we would get a response?
No, my office has a 24-hour turnaround on any questions that come in that we will get back to you. Now, I can't guarantee how long that's going to take. If something does need to be publicly posted, that's at minimum a week, right, by law. But if you were just to ask us a question to review it, my staff would get back to you within 24 business hours of the question coming in. So we know your projects are important to you, and we try to not to be a roadblock.
Okay. I think that answers mine, and I would really, even if it becomes active January 1st, my question is whether I would like to have the time that the chairman has recommended in terms of it, having Chris, as he offered, to provide some more information or a flow chart of sorts, and be able to, it may become applicable, or it goes into effect, but are we going to apply it to the applicants starting the first without, or are we going to put a little bit of a moratorium on that until we get through this effort?
So this, our policy would apply to approved projects after January 1, and those likely aren't going to occur until the February funding meeting. So I feel like having a follow-up in January with this flow chart will help us put us on a path of where we feel solid about it before it has to go into effect for any actual projects.
I think I can live with that. I appreciate your effort on that. Thank you.
Okay, Chris, thank you so much for joining us. Sorry that took about an hour to get through that discussion, but I think it's been hugely helpful for a lot of our board members understand, where we have some flexibility, where how this process could work, and coming back and talking through that flow chart, I think will be a great thing. So we'll be in touch with you.
All right. My door is always open. If anybody has any questions outside of this, I'm happy to help out.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay, quick time check. It's 9:36. We need to get through 7 projects in 2 hours. I'm putting that on the radar screen. So, and I'm also, for our applicants, these conversations will go a lot quicker if you settle in on the funding packages that the tool that the board is utilizing offers rather than something else outside of that. So with that, we'll get started with our first project for review, and that is the town of Glenwood. We'll turn some time over to Candace for a quick briefing on this project.
Thank you, Jonathan. The first project for discussion today of new projects is the town of Glenwood. As of the 2010 census, there were 464 people and 162 households in Glenwood Town. They want to do Main Street improvements. Their request is $755,000 in grants. This project consists of street improvements on 0.67 miles of Main Street roadway to increase the width of the roadway. You can read the applicant's description there. Glenwood Town's Main Street is the main access into Cove Mountain. The traffic is driving on the shoulders, and in order to pass oncoming traffic, because it's narrow, and it's getting narrower because the shoulders are crumbling off. The asphalt on the shoulder has broken up. The remaining asphalt is cracked and potholed beyond repair. So Glenwood would like to rotomill the existing asphalt, build up the shoulders, and then pave with hot mix asphalt, adding 2 feet to each side of the existing roads. In the public hearing, the shoulders, it states that the shoulders are damaged and the roads are narrowing, and they believe it's a safety issue. It probably is. Streets involved in the proposed project would include Main Street, 350 South, 270 East, and Sampson Lane, which are all in the need of repairs to shoulders and potholes. Glenwood encompasses 0.5 square miles. The funding in the minimum range is $189,000 in loan. Funding in the maximum range is $302,000 in loan. And that's the project.
Okay, I know we got a mayor on and Ryan Savage from on with us. Do you guys want to introduce yourselves and add anything to that project description?
Good morning. I'm Joey Rickenbaugh, mayor of Glenwood Town.
I'm Ryan Savage from Savage Ulrich Engineering. Part of the problem on this project is the town, it's been real narrow for years, and we've just lived with it. But recently the BLM approved a new campground just about 5 miles south of Glenwood. And so now we've got more trailer traffic and more truck traffic going through Main Street and down and going out onto Cold Mountain. You've got about between 16 and 18 feet of asphalt there now. So as you can imagine, trying to pass two trailers going each way on that Main Street is pretty tight. And so people are going down into the bar ditch and off their shoulder trying to get around. And so we're just trying to correct a problem that's kind of been pushed onto the Glenwood Town as far as what the BLM's doing with this new campground.
Yeah, it's just creating a safety issue, I guess. It's a major project, Main Street, is that we need to fix and clean up for the safety of the community, I guess. And then these other roads, they're all entrances to the county for, I'd imagine, all communities have been growing. Glenwood, the outskirts of Glenwood has been growing. They're beyond repair, basically. You need to rip them up and start all over. But that would Glenwood Town would then do their part making good access to the county roads outside of Glenwood.
Okay. I'm going to go to the board with questions here in a minute, but let me ask the one question I'm going to ask everybody today who's requesting something outside of what our standard guidelines are now. What's your capability is of taking a loan on this project, since that's what we're required to do these consistent decisions based on a variety of factors, and that is determining that you should be taking some loan on this project. So can you comment on that?
We understand that we could, yeah, a small amount. We're not a very big town. We don't have a lot of revenue, as you guys can see our financial stuff. But we basically presented it as here's our project, and we're willing to work in whatever direction you guys take it on the financing.
Okay, let's go to the board with questions, comments, or motions. Commissioner Ogden.
I just want to I guess kind of plead my case a little bit for this small town of Glenwood. They are kind of, the sad thing is that Main Street has become kind of a main road to get up onto the Cold Mountain, and it's getting worse as last year with everybody in this COVID situation. I was thinking that Glenwood should have put a street light in, as many people that we've had up and down that road this last year, and I think it's just going to get worse. ATV, it's the main road to get to Cold Mountain, as it's been expressed. And also, now that we've got BLM that's putting in another campground just above Glenwood, it's the streets are narrow, and they've got to definitely try to correct some of this problem getting these people through here. It'd be nice if we could route them around it, but and there is other routes to go, but to try to create that a different direction where this has been a road for over hundreds of years to get through up onto the Cove Mountain. But realizing that Glenwood is very small, they don't have a store, they don't have any kind of revenue. And if you look at their maintenance, it's about $39,000 a year, and they take about $29,000 of that to fill the potholes and try to fix the streets. It's another one of those situations where you're going to continue to have these problems in these small towns, and the traffic just keeps coming to rural Utah. So I guess I'm just pleading my case that I think it's a good, worthy project, and just want to take that, have that consideration.
Thank you, Commissioner. Go to Mayor Baker now.
Yeah, just as I read through the public hearings, the two that you had, one in October and one in November, I couldn't see where you had any public come in and comment. Are the public aware that you may be having to take a loan, some loan on this?
Yeah, we would have another public hearing on it at that point, but yeah, there's, I guess there wasn't a whole bunch of public there, but the council members and everybody else, yeah, we've just kind of basically told them that we would see where it all went.
And I guess kind of partly there, I think, and I know you're a small community, and I'm a mayor of a small community, bigger than you guys, but one of the aspects is, you know, surely you can go door to door and get your public out to them when you have those public hearings and at least have a few comments from your residents.
I understand, yeah. I guess we should have put forth more effort on getting them out. I know we did one public hearing and I didn't do it good, decent enough. So we tried for another one and there was actually two individuals that showed up late after we were already done. But, yeah, there's not a lot of public involvement over there in Glenwood, I guess. That's why they're stuck with me as the mayor.
Okay, let's go to, sorry, Mayor Baker, do you have other comments?
I was going to say thank you for his comments. So.
No, thank you.
Mr. Glucky.
Okay, a couple of quick comments. I guess, first off, to tell you, Mayor, can you hear me? It's still real quiet.
Yeah, we can't hear you very good.
I don't know, what the heck. It's not a matter of need of the project. It's a matter of, funding. And one thing that caught my eye is that I saw that your BNC spending was to the exact dollar of what came in on BNC. Is that correct, or used dollar? It seems like you got to be over or under that. To every single year, you're exactly to the number.
We try to budget everything just, yeah, pretty much the exact dollar. We have to have a good treasurer. Yeah, it's usually pretty close every year, yeah.
To the exact dollar. That's showed on the slide is the exact dollar, dollar amount. So, well, at this point, to be honest, with the financial information we have, I don't see any reason. This is, I guess, to the board, in my opinion, is that, at a minimum, I think we should do the medium funding range of $265,000 loan at 10 years at 0.5%. This is a question that, I guess, for Candace. Now that they're retiring almost, $17,000 in retiring debt in 2024. Can you defer things on like a road project like this, defer funding, defer payments?
Candace, you're on mute.
Well, can you tell me what the question was? I was going to send him an email.
The question was, how long you can defer payments?
Oh, 2 years. But the interest accrues. You pay the interest payment annually. And that's usually a year after the loan closes that starts.
So it could be up to 3 years before a payment was needed.
Yes. Yes. Principal starts.
Does that answer your question, Greg?
Yeah, I guess here's another question on the application. Is that
it seems like the financials and everything is strong, but there, and this is to the mayor, you know, it says like the bringing in the taxes is about $20,000 a year, yet you're, yet you have loans out for about $25,000 a year that you're paying out. I mean, is there a general fund that isn't included, or again, it goes back to my question that I don't have a good sense of affordability.
That's why you get Glenwood spends exactly what they make, I guess, or bring in, I guess. It's
looking at what your taxes are and what your loans are. So you've got $5,000 more in loan than you're bringing in every year. So where's that other $5,000 coming from?
They'd probably be pulling it out of the coffers, I guess.
All right, let's go to Mr. Zanotti.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Being a UDOT person, I would just like to let you know that by waiting on this road, it's going to be even more expensive by 3-4 months from now. You need to take care of that immediately, especially when your shoulders are starting to deteriorating. The road goes with it. Drainage and wash and all is going to be. My next question is that in your October minutes, Mayor O'Ron, you had $755,000. November minutes reflects $765,000. What was the change of scope? And what are you going to be enough? $750,000, is that enough for you to do the road?
That must have been a typo.
Yeah.
That must have been a typo. It's $755,000.
Well, okay. Probably me. My bad, because I was the one.
All right, then I just want to make sure that you didn't shortchange yourself and like requesting the money for the asphalt.
Oh, thank you.
If you want to give us another $10,000, we'll take it.
Hey, you asked for it. It's just right there. You asked for it, we'll give you one.
Let's go to Mayor Baker.
Yes, I think Greg's comment also was a motion, wasn't it?
I didn't quite hear it in the form of a motion, but if you want to make the motion, that's fine.
I'd make that motion that we fund this project at the medium range of $265,000 in loan, $490,000 in grant at 0.5% for 10 years, and they can extend starting their payments for 2 years.
Okay, that motion's in order. Is there a second?
I'll second that motion, Mr. Chair.
All right, so the motion made by Mayor Baker, seconded by Treasurer Dampshin. It's a $265,000 loan, 10 years at 0.5%, deferred for 2 years, and a $490,000 grant. Further discussion to that motion? Seeing none, we'll place that motion for a vote. Pam, roll call vote, please.
Treasurer Dampshin?
Yes.
Mr. Galecki? Greg? Mr. Galecki?
Aye.
Thank you. Commissioner Ogden?
Aye.
Commissioner Lytle?
Aye.
Mayor Baker?
Aye.
Mr. Stevens?
Aye.
Commissioner Dalton?
Aye.
Commissioner Hansen?
Aye.
Commissioner Adams?
Aye.
Mr. Zanotti?
Aye.
All votes in the affirmative.
All right, that passes unanimously. So you're on the priority list for the February funding meeting, and we look forward to talking to you then.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next application is the Duchesne County Municipal Building Authority, and we'll turn some time over to Candace for a quick briefing on this one.
Number two on today's agenda is from Duchesne County Municipal Building Authority. It's going through Duchesne County MBA, but it's a Roosevelt Branch Library and Community Center. The request is $4,565,000. Of which they have requested 50-50, $2,283,000 loan for 30 years at 1%, and a $2,282,000 grant. The median funding range indicates a $4,337,000 loan. This project consists of the construction of a 16,700-square-foot energy-efficient metal library building with ADA-accessible 80 on 80 North, 200 West. Now, that location is close to the Roosevelt Aquatic Center. There are two ball fields in what is called Central Park along 200 West that will be the new library site. It will include a new meeting space for activities and an outdoor patio. New library will have 50% more shelf space. They intend to start construction in March of 2021 and complete the project in January of 2022. In the public hearing, citizens asked about a piano like Vernal. I would just like to have an editorial note there. No. The piano in Vernal was fundraised and purchased by an outside party, and they did note that in the public hearing. But it was a good public hearing. It should be noted that the land right now, as I stated, is on the site of the Aquatic Center. That land has been used as collateral, but we're in the process of what is required for CIB bonds in regard to that land is that we're just getting to where we'll verify the cost of the remaining land so that it remains as sufficient collateral for the Aqua Center or the Aquatic Center bond. That should be done by February. So it's a large, ambitious, wonderful project. That's it.
Great. Thank you, Candace. Sure, we have a few folks on here from Duchesne County, and maybe Commissioner Hansen's taking this. I don't know. But whoever's on here to talk about it, if you'll introduce yourselves.
All righty. This is Commissioner Greg Todd. With me, I'm Commissioner for Duchesne County. With me, I have to my left Daniel Motley, our library director. On the right, I have Dixie Swayze. She's from the Yalmont area. She's on the board. And to the left is Jessica Shaw. She's from Roosevelt. They are on the board. Just as a side note, we have others that weren't able to be here today. It's been a great board. Several are watching virtually. They're from all over Duchesne County, from Taviona, Duchesne, Roosevelt, and the Alawan area. This board is a great board, and they vigorously vetted this project. It's been really great. We also have Kendrick Thomas. He's our project manager. He's somewhere, I hope.
Yep.
And he'll participate if he needs to with Jones in the Mill. We also, they're not able to be here today, is Kim and Randon Campbell with Campbell and Associates. They are our architects. In respect to this library, I have a great perspective of a library. I've been all over the United States and spent lots of time in libraries because when I'd be out of town, I'd go to a certain city, find a hotel room, and I'd find a library because that was my spot to see what the community was like. And I feel that we can do better in respect to Roosevelt because we need a better library. I've been a commissioner since 2015. My goal is to get this library done before I leave, whenever that is. So I'm excited that we have Daniel Mockley here. He's been for 5 years and has the same goals that I do to get this done. We're going to turn the time to him, and we respectfully appreciate some good conversation about it. Daniel.
Thanks, Commissioner Todd, and thank you, Board, for having us today. The Roosevelt Branch is one of our two libraries in Duchesne County, and it does serve our largest population, including many residents from Uinta County, Western County, since it's on the border, and Ballard. But it is our smallest and oldest library facility at only 4,500 square feet. Candace already kind of gave you a rundown of what features are being proposed in this, Before COVID, we had 55,000 visits a year, circulated 80,000 items, and we just had four public meetings. I think you've seen two. In the packet I read, you had two, but we actually had four, and we did in-person 100 surveys as well, asking about the project. It started out 19,000 square feet. We trimmed that down to 16,700 to try to get it into a decent budget. And the option for a new build over remodel was brought up, and the public widely went for that. We put a lot of thought into the operations and maintenance of this building. We have a limited budget, and so we kept it to one level. And we worked a lot on sight lines in the building, as you can see on the floor plan, to minimize need for more staff and try to give them as much control as possible. We cut out things that are very trendy in some libraries, you know, maker spaces and things like that that require more staff that we can't afford and just don't meet the needs that was proposed in our surveys and in the public feedback that we got in our meetings and focus groups. We've been preparing for this a long time. We set aside funds and have utilized them, as you saw in the in-kind, for feasibility study, the purchase of the land that Candace mentioned, and most of the design costs are pretty much wrapped up as well. We've done that already. We have made estimates on what we can pay in annual payments each year with our funds and looking ahead. And assuming the new operations and management that will come with the building while also maintaining our other library and its services, we have submitted that funding scenario to you. We know that that's different from the tool, but we hope you'll put that into consideration. Scenarios lower than that will further increase our anticipated annual payment that will be challenging, really challenging for us to sustain. But we thank you for your consideration for this project that's gotten a lot of public support positively and will really be a benefit not just to Roosevelt City, but other residents from Altamont, but commonly come in Ballard as well. Thank you.
Kendrick, do you have anything?
I don't. Just mention that Randon Campbell actually is on the line with us too, with Campbell and Associates.
Great. Well, thank you for the presentation of the project. Having personally toured this with Commissioner Todd and Hansen, it's a great project. I mean, I'm excited about it. Let's see what the board has for questions. Go to Mr. Zanotti first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My compliments to commissioners, to library board, and to the public to be fully engaged in this process. It is a beautiful, beautiful project, and I think you've done a fabulous job, especially Chalice Jensen, for preparing such a beautiful minutes on both of those public hearings, October 8th and November 2nd. She's going to be hearing from my wife to prepare my obituary for that detail. I also would like to express my sincere gratitude to our dear friend, Commissioner Hansen, for being so fully engaged in the process, offering personal feelings and experiences that she had from the past libraries without being imposer of the opinion. Thank you. Thank you, dear Commissioner Hansen, for that. And I'm pretty sure you made a big impression on Treasure Downsion because of the having 12 different architecture committees answering your SQs. That was a beautiful thing, and thank you for choosing Campbell from St. George. That's my comment, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
All right, let's go to Commissioner Hansen.
Well, first of all, just like to thank our wonderful committee member from St. George for those kind comments. And truly, you know, there are projects that come through that you are especially proud of. Really want to thank Commissioner Todd. I think there's very few commissioners. We're all given departments that we're over, but I don't think I've ever met another commissioner that was so passionate about library services. He would drive all the way back from Salt Lake, stay up all night, do whatever it took to make a board meeting, and then go back out to meetings at the Capitol or wherever. So my appreciation to him and the great staff. This truly is a good project. It's been reworked over a half a dozen times for efficiency and to lower costs. So I just want to share my support and appreciation to the work that's gone on into this. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Brenda, can you pull up the tool and kind of show us where the ranges are here? Is it possible to increase the size? I have pretty good eyesight, but even that's straining my eyes. So looks like the minimum.
Sorry, let me do that off screen and then I'll bring it back.
While you're doing that, we'll go to Mr. Galecki for a question, comment.
I sound like a broken record, but you know, being from a small town and being Roosevelt, I acknowledge the the need for the project, and the great thing that the committee has done to put it together. A couple things I also wanted to point out is I know it's not necessarily apples to apples, but they're putting a project together of 16,000 square feet, and it's 29% of the cost of what is going to be in Kane County for about the same size of stuff. So it kind of shows a little bit of how they're trying to budget things. Question for the commissioner or the board is, so it was those ball fields are like $370,000. Is that a market cost on that? Is that appraised at that cost?
All right, I'll kind of help with that. Ironically, those ball fields I played on when I was 10 years old, just for perspective. But in our negotiations with Roosevelt City, and their perspective was, we have a ball field right now. We need another ball field. You need to help us have the opportunity to have this ball field somewhere else. So it was kind of a replacement. The negotiations, and you can add to this, Daniel, if you want, but the negotiations were considerably higher before it was agreed upon. Want to add a little bit more to that?
Yeah, if I may, Greg, just a little context. Like you said, may I also mention, for almost half a year, we were searching around at different sites. We even went around with Roosevelt City Manager. We looked at 7, I think, possible locations, but they all ended up being very much outside of the center of the city. And we did look at another one that was very close, but it would have required us to buy a ton of extra land that we just didn't need and would have had to been, we would have been holding on to it forever. This was right in the center of the city where, it's on the same block as the library. It's with the park. It's with the pool. It was optimal, I think, location, but also probably one of the better prices we could find that actually fit the project too. And we do appreciate the city council, being willing to drop their price down to what it was, because the money that we provided won't be quite enough to build the new building they need. So they, in a way, they helped us in that regard as well. They did give up those two builds to help us out, because they also, I feel, are very much behind the project as well.
So a couple more questions. So I assume is there any plans for the current library or the property? At least seems like you should be able to get some return on that. So twofold. Okay. What is your plan? Was it considered that potentially would it have made sense to knock down the current building and just rebuild it at that location?
Okay, just as a information to help everyone understand, years ago, the state made it where you couldn't have Roosevelt City and Duchesne County taxing for the same building. That was a Roosevelt City library. Duchesne County took the library over with some negotiations with Duchesne County. That library is, that building is, and property is owned by Roosevelt City. So we had no negotiations in respect to that. It is their property.
and they've been maintaining the landscaping and other efforts on that building too since we've been there.
And we all wanted a clean break too. So.
Then one last comment, I guess, is that I see that between 2024 and 2025, you're retiring over $100,000 of debt. So that on a loan payment, that should help quite a bit.
Well, one thing we need to remember, in a sense, that Barry is a tax entity in itself under Livingston County.
I didn't quite catch that, Commissioner. What was that?
Oh, I just said the Livingston County Library is actually a taxing entity within Livingston County.
It has its own tax levy, and it's not part of the general fund for regular operation.
Yeah, we're looking at the MBA payment structure, and what you're saying is that even though you'll be saving some debt service, as Greg mentions, in 4 years, that's not necessarily being deployed to help out the library. Is that what you're saying, Commissioner?
Yes.
Is that large enough, Jonathan?
Yeah, I can see it. So this is, and, you know, I think when this project came up, when I was doing my review with the staff, really the thing that's pushing it up into the high loan category is that libraries and community centers are not classified in the need category like a water or sewer system. So that's what's in our tool driving it up to a higher loan amount.
We understand that.
All right. Well, that looks like we don't have more questions. Do we have any motions from the board? Mr. Zanotti. You're on mute. Okay.
I would like to honor their request based on the fact that the smaller community, they have really worked very hard to get to this point, not just yesterday, for many years. And they've spent quite a bit of amount of human talents, energy, and time. I think we should award them 50-50 as they have requested. That's my motion, if it is acceptable.
So let me just ask with your motion, I think one thing we're gonna have to be clear about when we're going outside of the tool is the reasons for exceptions to the tool. I'm kind of hearing some ancillary reasons. They've done a good planning job, I agree, and it's been a well-supported community project. Are there any other things that you would really want to say that would require an exception to our tool?
Well, I know that we don't favor the community centers and all, but the library is the brain, the host place that everybody comes to understand about the community. I know that some people fear that they're going to go away, but they will not go away. I promise you they're going to stay. And the way they have designed this particular library with the smart solutions, they're converting already to new technology by having computers and learning centers. If I'm traveling to some places that I don't know what to do, I promise the first thing I go to the library to check out the community to find out what is there for me, how I can meet the people, resources. And this is going to be the one for the Duchesne County to meet for many years, and small communities like Roosevelt and cities to come to. It is the greatest investment from us as a state stakeholders to help them.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to echo Mr. Zanotti's comments a little bit. I think that, you know, as we group so-called low-need projects, a library project has to be among the highest of low need, in my opinion, based on its ties to education and literacy. And as Nagi pointed out, the technology component is significant. When you have rural distressed parts of the state, high levels of unemployment, people that struggle to even be part of our sort of cyber community, if they want to interact with government, if they want to make a grandma request, et cetera, and they don't have internet at home, libraries are extraordinarily essential, and they're not what they used to be. And I'm with Nagy on this. So you just, it's awkward to group a library facility with some of these other so-called low-need projects. And I would also support the notion that this is a higher, or perhaps the highest of low-need projects, if we have to categorize it as such.
Okay, so is that a second to the motion?
Yeah, let's let that be a second to the motion.
Let me put that motion in order here, and then we can start to address this. I know we got many people ready to comment on this. So the motion as proposed by Mr. Zanotti, seconded by Treasurer Dampshin, is $2,283,000 loan, 30 years at 1%, and a $2,282,000 grant. And the justification I think we're hearing for an exception is that, and this probably is more of a comment on revamping the tool on how it handles library projects, because right now they're kind of in this different category that's pushing it, the suggestion up to a higher loan amount. And maybe what we want to do really is revisit the conversation about where libraries rank in that tool for want versus need in the community. And that would probably tell us something different if we modified the tool. So that's the justification on it. Let's go to discussion on the motion. We'll start with Mayor Baker.
Okay. Thank you. Treasurer Jamskins beat me to it. I was going to second that motion. With the need in libraries and with the in rural areas, it's so critical. One of the things I was going to bring up is maybe because they are a producing county and have 44% federal lands, 22% tribal. So that puts them up there. I was going to make the suggestion that maybe we look at it at a half a percent on that 30-year loan. That would be one of, that's my comment.
Okay, comment only?
I hate to change and do a substitute motion unless Mr. Sonati is willing to look and reconsider that at a half percent. I would encourage him to do that.
You're on mute, Nagy. Sorry. Nagy, you're on mute.
I really don't dare to push the position and then tip it over. So let's just stay with the one person as they have requested. They know what they want. Mayor Baker.
Let's go to Mr. Galecki. You're on mute, Greg.
Shoot, I was trying. Hey, I guess my question is thinking about the funds, what would it do to their loan payment if they dropped it to, had a $1 million more in loan, but dropped the interest rate to 0.5%? I guess, Candace, could you do that and see what it would do?
She's working on that right now, I can see.
So you want the difference between a 5% or point? Let's do the 5% loan.
Start with the payment of a $2,283,000 loan, 30 years at 1%.
Right.
Computer slow. Oh. Oh, Brenda's doing it.
88,462. Now the $3,283,000 at 0.5%. What is that payment? I can't see the whole screen, so all we're seeing is $118,000. So it's $30,000 more. Greg.
So Brenda, can you can we do you have a way to increase the loan and increase the loan, decrease the percentage to 0.5%. And, you know, what I'm trying to get to is having to have the same payment, but just have more loan.
Do the minimum, or do the maximum loan, Brenda.
No, just put the loan at $2.5 million at 0.5%, and let's see what the payment says. That's pretty close. It's $89,000, so it's a $1,500 difference at $2.5 million as opposed to $2.283 million at 1%. Does that answer your question, Greg?
Yeah, it does. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Lytle.
So I think I probably should have lowered my hand.
Okay.
In the event that we're still – is there a substitute motion on the table then?
There is not.
Okay. I support where we're at.
Okay.
I'd be willing to call the question if there's nobody else.
Looks like we have Commissioner Ogden will take his question or discussion.
Well, I guess my question is we're trying to stay fairly constant. You know, we just barely passed the last one here and within the medium range, and now we're having a hesitation doing this in the medium range. I'd like to see it take just a little bit more loan if we could. And I don't know if that's going to get any support or not. I'd like to go to 75%, 5% like we did on the, or a 0.5% on the last one, and 25%. A lot of work. That's my motion.
I support that. This is Greg. I'd support that motion.
Okay, so that's a motion made by Commissioner Ogden and seconded by Mr. Galecki. Can you pull up the amounts for me when we're talking 75-25?
Big difference.
Okay. You're going to have to change that because we manually input that in, so it's not reading 75% of the amount. Okay, 75% would be a $3,424,000 loan, 30 years at 0.5%.
Yes, that's correct.
Commissioner Ogden. And a $1,141,000 grant. That would put the payment at $123,192. So that substitute motion was made by Commissioner Ogden and seconded by Mr. Galecki. Further discussion to that substitute motion? Seeing none, we'll place substitute motion for a vote. And Pam, will you do a roll call vote on the substitute motion?
Treasurer Damson?
Yes.
Mr. Galecki?
Yes.
Commissioner Ogden?
Yes.
Commissioner Lytle?
Yes.
Mayor Baker? You're on mute, Mayor.
Sorry, no.
Okay. Mr. Stevens?
Yes.
Commissioner Dalton?
Yes.
Commissioner Hansen?
I'm going to have to vote no on this one. Thank you, though.
Commissioner Adams?
Yes.
And Mr. Zanotti?
No.
I'd like to clarify my vote to make sure I'm understanding what I voted. This was to – I may have misunderstood. Are we on the motion or on the substitute?
Substitute.
My substitute vote would be nay. I thought we were on the motion.
All right.
6 votes in the affirmative and 4 dissenting.
Okay, so that motion passes. So what's on the priority list is that 75-25 split. So we'll see you back in February for a final discussion on that, and we look forward to that.
Should have stayed on for the 0.5%.
We appreciate the opportunity.
I apologize for my confusion. That's okay. Thanks. We'll see you in the February meeting. Thank you to Shane County and all the group working on that great project.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next project is the town of Fayette. Candace, can you give us a quick briefing on this?
Number three on the agenda today is the town of Fayette for street and drainage improvements. Their request is $175,000 grant. This project consists of roadway and drainage improvements, pothole repair, and chip seal to include all streets from Main Street to 2nd East and from 3rd North to 5th South. The median funding range is a $70,000 loan, as you will note. The issue with that is that anything less than $100,000 is a very expensive loan. The bonding costs are the same. The maximum is still at $88,000 loan, as according to the tool. It is road repair, 10-year loan.
Okay, we have the town on with us.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, great. Introduce yourself, Mayor.
I'm Mayor Bartholomew.
Great. Anything you want to add to Candace's description?
No, I think she summarized that quite well. Thank you.
Okay, so I think one of our deficiencies in the tool, we've always talked about having a minimum amount of a loan. So it's spitting out a median range of a $70,000 loan, and we've typically had $100,000 be our minimum loan amount. So anyway, I just put that out there for our consideration and discussion on this item. Let's go to the board with any questions on the projects or motions. Mr. Zanotti?
So are we considering $70,000 loan or we're not in this category? Because we never had in the past. We've always saved $100,000 minimum. So
that's what I said. You could, though, but it's an expensive loan.
It's possible, but it's not our typical practice to do a loan that small because you're going to add in a bunch of bonding costs, so it makes it an expensive loan. So one thing we may do in the future is just set the minimum threshold in our tool at $100,000 for a loan. Does that answer your question, Mr. Zanotti?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes.
Okay. Let's go to Mr. Galecki. You're on mute, Greg.
Actually, what happens is that I lose that screen while I'm looking at the various other things, so it takes me a minute to give it up. I know we don't do minimum of $100,000 loans. My thought is, and I guess this is the applicant, you have $125,000 in cash. My thought is, what happens if you took a $300,000, you kept your cash, did a $300,000 loan at 0.5% instead of 1%? Could you handle that?
The size of the loan?
There's a $300,000 loan. Keep the cash. That was the suggestion. So, Mayor, do you have a comment on that?
$300,000.5%.
Yes.
We just closed out two of our other payments. I suspect we could. We're a very small community with no businesses in it. Our demographics are mostly the elderly. A lot of our income comes off a tax base, so. I try to stay away from that. I can't say we couldn't afford that, but it would be taxing on us.
Okay. Okay, let's go to Mayor Baker.
Maybe I could make a substitute motion here.
No, there's no motion on the table, so you'll be the original motion.
Okay, so this will be the original motion then. I would like to propose a $100,000 loan, 10-year, 1%, and a $75,000 grant.
Okay, that motion's in order. Is there a second?
I'll second. This is Irene.
Okay, so a motion made by Mayor Baker, seconded by Commissioner Hansen, to approve a $100,000 loan, 10 years, at 1%, and a $75,000 grant. Further discussion to that motion? Commissioner Ogden.
Yes, I'd just like to change that to interest rate to 0.5%. That seems to be what we're doing today.
Okay. Again, the tool is suggesting interest rates as well, so I don't want to make this the whole standard, but okay, so that's a substitute motion, Commissioner Ogden?
Yes.
Is there a second to the substitute?
This is Pye. I'll second that.
Okay, so substitute motion by Commissioner Ogden and seconded by Mr. Stevens to approve a $100,000 loan, 10 years at 0.5%, and a $75,000 grant. Discussion to the substitute motion? Seeing none, we'll place the substitute motion for a vote. Pam, roll call, please.
Treasurer Damschen?
Yes.
Mr. Galecki?
Yes.
Commissioner Ogden?
Yes.
Commissioner Lytle?
Jack. You're on mute, Jack. I need your vote. Come back to me. It's not another conversation, it looks like.
Okay, Mayor Baker?
Yes.
Mr. Stevens?
Yes.
Commissioner Dalton?
Yes.
Commissioner Hansen?
Yes.
Commissioner Adams?
Yes.
Mr. Zanotti?
Aye.
Mayor Baker, can I get your vote, please?
I voted aye, yes.
It was Jack Lytle.
Commissioner
Lytle. Oh, I'm sorry. Commissioner Lytle, sorry about that.
You must have us on mute right now, so we'll mark him absent for the vote.
So 9 in favor, 1 absent.
Okay, that motion passes. So that's on the priority list for the February funding meeting. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, next project. This is with it, so hopefully we can get this done efficiently. Castle Valley Special Service District. Candace, a briefing on this, please.
This is an annual consolidated project that the Castle Valley Special Service District brings in. This is the 2021 list. Their request is for $2 million, a $1 million loan, 6 years at 2.5%. You will notice that 2.5% is on the high end, and a $1 million grant. They have applicant cash of $16,000. This project consists of improvements to streets. It's the normal through the community, Elmo, Cleveland, Huntington, Castledale, Clawson, Farron, Emory. The interest rate is fungible. You'll notice that the maximum range is a $1,300,000 loan, 15-year, at 2%. But they do a 6-year loan because they do. This is a general obligation bond. I'm bringing that to your recollection, that they do, and then they allocate funding out of that general obligation bond and expect to have it paid off in 6 years. So that's what this is, road, streets, water, whatever the communities of the Castle Valley Special Service District need that year. That's it.
Thank you, Candace. Jacob, you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, Board. Yes, Jacob Sharp, Castle Valley Special Service District. Good to see some of your faces on the side of the screen.
Anything you want to add to that description?
I want to excuse our engineer, Merrill, who has the the coronavirus and elected not to participate today. Alex Buxton is also on here with me. Thank you, Candace, for the introduction. Just a reminder, these are all smaller projects throughout 8 cities and towns that we serve in our service district. We draw the projects from our capital facilities plan that was updated in 2019. The mayor and council in these communities select the order or the projects that they want done based on their community and their needs at the time. I can see that the CIB's changed a little bit with this matrix and the way that you're offering things. Obviously, we would prefer the funding package the way that we requested it. But the additional loan, I think the way it's proposed is an additional loan for and then lengthening the time. If we can, in our request, we requested 2.5% interest on the loan portion, and if we were able to reduce the that interest rate down to 1.5%, but keep that repayment at 6 years, that would be good by us. Or even if, since we're adjusting interest rates by 0.5%, if we can go a little less than that, that would be great. We've looked at the payment scenarios, and the payment scenarios are not that different on those two different loans, $1 million loan compared to $1.1 million loan. And we certainly could make that work. Reminder, though, obviously we would prefer the lower loan amount. But if we take the little bit more loan, again, perhaps we could get a reduced interest rate, and certainly would prefer the 1.5% interest rate, if not lower. So I think that's all I'm going to say, and turn it over to the board.
Okay, thank you. We'll go first to Commissioner Adams.
Jonathan, I'd like to make a motion to approve the medium range, $1.1 million, I think in loan, and $900,000 in grant at 1% interest for 6 years.
Okay, that motion's in order. Is there a second?
Commissioner Ogden seconds that motion.
Okay. Commissioner Ogden's got a second on it. So the motion made by Commissioner Adams, seconded by Commissioner Ogden, is a $1.1 million loan, 6 years at 1% in a $900,000 grant. Further discussion of that motion? I know some of you had your hands raised, so I'm assuming you're in support of what's been said. So I see no further questions, and we'll place that motion for a vote. Pam, roll call, please.
Treasurer Damchin?
Yes.
Mr. Galecki?
Aye.
Commissioner Ogden?
Aye.
Commissioner Lytle?
Aye.
Commissioner Baker? Or, I'm sorry, Mayor Baker?
Aye.
Thank you. Mr. Stevens?
Aye.
Commissioner Dalton.
Clarification, that's a 6-year
yes.
motion, correct, Chairman?
6 years. Yep, 6 years.
Aye.
Commissioner Hansen?
Aye.
Commissioner Adams?
Aye.
And Mr. Zanotti?
Aye.
All votes in the affirmative.
Great. Thanks, that passed unanimously on the priority list for the February funding meeting. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, rolling along here. Let's do one more project for a quick break. Green River City. Candace, give us a briefing on this project.
Number 5 on the agenda today is Green River City. It's for Green River Riverbank Restoration and Enhancements, Phase 1. Their request is $179,337. The median range would be $117,000 loan, 30-year at 1%. They have applicant cash of $150,000, Emory County cash of $12,005, Recreational Trails Program cash, $100,000, and Utah Outdoor Rec cash of $150,000. My question would be the status of that cash. I would also seek clarification because we have a very broad scope there. That's for the whole project. But there are components of the project that cannot be funded by some of those funding sources. So it has been indicated that in the public hearing minutes that the CIB funding would cover the engineering, design, and permitting. So if the applicant could clarify that. There are four phases in this project when it becomes completely done. This is phase one, Main Street focus area, which is the John Wesley Powell Museum area, and they will do a lot of enhancements to the river and to the area where the museum is, and that's the project.
Okay, I know we have folks from Green River on the line with us. If you want to introduce yourselves and answer any of those questions or any other things you want to add to the applicant application. You're all on mute if you're talking, so. But I can see that you're here.
Okay, can you hear me now, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, I can.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present to you today. And thank you for your past support and everything you do and have done, which is greatly appreciated. Ma'am, I believe you asked the purpose for the CIB funding.
Yeah, what would it be? What was the scope that CIB funding would be covering?
Right. My understanding was for permitting and design and things like that along those lines, but kind of a general project support was my understanding.
Is there anything else you want to add to the description of the project?
The river is an incredible asset for us, but quite honestly, it's extremely underutilized. And I think this project would go a long ways towards rectifying that issue. In phase one, we've got a slab stone terrace bank, small watercraft access, scenic overlook on the river, a swimming hole, which we have no city pool, by the way, a pedestrian trail, and an accessible submerged boat ramp, which currently the only boat ramp in the city is located in a pay area where you have to pay a fee to access the ramp there. And then landscaping, beautification, and interpretive signage. This project has gotten really, really broad-based support and has had a lot of cooperative entities involved in this. So citizens, businessmen, state agencies, federal, county, the schools, our local schools, and it's got really broad-based support, and of course from the city as well. We wholeheartedly support this project. And as Candace said, we've got quite a bit of skin in the game, as well as putting $150,000 cash in. We purchased the land next to the museum, as well, that will be used for part of this program. And we've also contracted with River Restorations, which I'm not sure if Eric's on with us or not. And that is well into six-figure commitment that we've got going on there. This would be huge for us recreationally, culturally, historically, environmentally for the river and ecologically. There are a lot of benefits. And my big concern here is the recreation aspect. As you know, Moab is pretty overrun right now, and this project would really allow us to serve as kind of a recreation alternative, a good recreation alternative for just not only our local citizens, but from visitors from the Wasatch Front and elsewhere. And I think that's about all I have. If anyone has any questions, if I can't answer them, hopefully Eric's on and he can. He's our project manager and subject matter expert.
Hi, this is Eric McCulley. I'm with River Restoration and happy to be here. And I can answer any questions. I just want to, you know, recognize the fact that I know this board usually, you know, is focused on the built infrastructure. And this may be a little shift outside of a lot of the types of funding you've looked at before. But one of the great assets Green River has is its namesake, and that's the river. So it's really the benefits of this natural infrastructure to the community. And you know, the mayor you know, talked about the general project, but this is the first of many projects really to get folks down to the river and then to draw visitors in to have that more sustainable economy for Green River as we're seeing this outdoor recreation impacts, you know, increasing in the state. And especially with COVID, people really need to go outside and you know, close in on the natural resource benefits. So that's really the main focus of this project is really the natural infrastructure.
Okay, let's go to the board for some questions. Mr. Zanotti.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mayor, have you secured the local cash and also the grant from the federal and state agencies?
Thus far, Mr. Zanotti, we do have the local cash is in hand. We're good to go with that. And then Outdoor Rec actually funded at their maximum amount, $150,000. And then we've got we're trying to secure some funds, of course, from CIB and from the Coal Country Strike Force. I'm sorry, did that answer your question, Mr. Zanotti?
What does the federal? So you have federal government grants, $100,000, and you have also the state grant is at $850,000.
Those are the $150,000 from Outdoor Rec is secure. The federal is not, sir.
Okay.
Yeah, not yet.
What about the permits along the river? Are you going to have a challenge with the environmental agencies of any kind?
Eric, would you take that one?
Yes, I can speak to that. So we are engaged with the regulatory agencies now. One of the biggest challenges is the endangered fish in the Green River, and we're working on getting to a concept design where we know what the impacts will be and initiating that discussion in the beginning of 2021. We've already talked to the state, Forestry, Fire, and State Lands as far as permitting from the state agencies, and we're just working on getting our permit packages together. But the way we've worked on these projects across the nation is we dewater the areas in a way that's not going to impact those fish. And I don't know if it's enviable, but I get to write up the documentation on that and say how we're not going to impact the fish. And we have a good relationship with those regulatory agencies. So we are initiating those discussions. As far as the federal discussions, we've had brief discussions, but we're trying to come up with what our impacts are going to be, and that's the next step in January.
And the last question I have is that what about the easements from the private owners? Have they been secured?
Eric, where exactly are we at with that?
This is the city property. Where the museum is, and the other owner is the state of Utah, Forestry, Fire, and State Lands, Sovereign Lands. There are no other interests, and we have been talking with Forestry, Fire, and State Lands. They've given us the nod. They're going to give us a permit, and we just need to submit that permit. So that's also, we've been talking to Forestry, Fire, and State Lands for over a year on this project, and they said it's not going to be a problem. They actually want to bring some funds to it as well. So, but the only, you know, most of it's on Green River City land.
I suggest that you get their signatures as soon as possible before time changes and things changes.
Thank you. We will.
All right, let's go to Mr. Galecki.
Hey, I've got a couple engineering questions and then one for the mayor, I guess. First to you, Eric. I see, you know, wetland delineation and then your 401, 404 permit. Those are both only about $4,000. You can feel comfortable that you can do a wetland delineation for only $4,000?
You know, I've already done the wetland delineation, and there's only an ordinary high water mark, so there aren't actually any wetland impacts because the river comes down so steeply, or the bank comes down steeply, and then it just turns to river. So that's already been completed. And yeah, it was just a day out there. It's a pretty small area, and there's actually no wetlands. So we've already completed that. And it just took a couple days.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then the 404, I guess the core winds up commenting, but like you said, if it's above the high water mark, it should be pretty easy. The next question, yeah. is that, you know, you have engineering, line 45, you have engineering for 34,000, and then down at the bottom you have another engineering for 82,000. Is that, can you explain what's going on there? It looks like it's double, you know, I mean, it seems like it's already covered, and then there's another 82,000 in engineering.
So we'll pull up this document that Greg's referring to. There's two engineering estimates in the budget, and he's wondering the difference of them.
Huh. I'm wondering if one is for a different phase of the project, or if that's, I'm not entirely sure.
So,
Kone would know better on that. Our city administrator, but I don't believe she's a presenter on this.
Yeah, I think that, oh, the engineering design above, I'm sorry, that may have been for the broader program. So this was, you know, we brought in basically all of the different resource areas, and I think that funding might have already been expended in this particular budget. We've, this is a cost estimate that we created. There are needs for structural engineering design, and this, that may have just been kind of a carryover from before, that other 34,000 in engineering. In general, it's about 82,000 for the engineering for this. And the previous work that's been done for all of the different projects, which is more of a conceptual level engineering, I believe that's been complete.
I guess. So I see this is phase one of three phases, and I guess I should back up and say that, you know, I'm from a small town without a swimming pool, and, you know, the idea of developing a swimming hole, but then also what this would do for Green River, I think it's a great project. But I also see that there's more work to be done. Here's what I'm throwing out, is rather than I would propose and I guess I'm throwing this out to the applicant, is to keep your cash, $150,000 cash, take a $300,000 loan at a 0.5% for 30 years. It seems to me that would provide you more, sustainability on, future projects. But so I'm throwing that out to see what the applicant would, what they think about that.
That's an interesting concept, Mr. Galecki. Appreciate that. And, you know, the numbers wise, I need to, we need to discuss that with the city administrator and our budget officers, but, that's an interesting concept, sir.
All right. Let's go to Commissioner Dalton.
Yeah, I think Kyle was first, but I was just going to say that it sounded like there's a lot of answers or a lot of questions that need to be answered before this money is allocated and put on the pending list. I think this needs to go back and get the permitting, get all the information, and then come back for funding.
All right, let's go to Mr. Stevens.
Yeah, my question was just relative to the fact in the description indicate that you're going to develop a swimming hole. And the question there was, what type of liability issues do you have, and how are you going to minimize those?
I can answer that. In general, a lot of folks are concerned about the liability of rivers and getting anyone near these rivers. People have to have some personal responsibility for their decisions. There will be signs put up in this area that indicate, there's a water hazard. Helper City has developed something like this in their city. Ogden City also has it, and there's cities across the country that are realizing the rivers are an asset and not just a liability. And so every bit of, ability the city has to let people know that, if you can't swim, don't get in the river, you know, will be done through posting signs and public education and things like that.
Okay, thank you for that explanation.
Mr. Zanotti.
Just a comment for Commissioner Dalton that in the past we have approved projects contingent upon securing funds or permits from agencies. That's just my comment. Thank you.
Okay, I see no further. Well, Mr. Galecki.
Well, since you said I think you're going to say you're going to go to a motion. I'll go to a motion that we set up a $300,000 loan at 0.5% for 30 years.
I second that motion.
Okay, that motion's in order, made by Mr. Galecki, seconded by Mr. Zanotti to approve a $300,000 loan, 30 years at 0.5%.
Keep the cash.
This is the keep the cash concept. So further discussion to that motion? Seeing none, we'll place it for a roll call vote. Pam?
Treasurer Dampson?
Yeah. Yes.
Mr. Galecki?
Aye.
Commissioner Ogden?
Yes.
Commissioner Lytle?
Aye.
Mayor Baker?
Aye.
Mr. Stevens?
Aye.
Commissioner Dalton?
Aye.
Commissioner Hansen?
Yes.
Commissioner Adams?
Yes.
And Mr. Zanotti?
Aye.
Thank you. All in the affirmative.
Okay, that passes unanimously. So that's on the priority list for the February funding meeting. So you got some stuff to talk with your community about, and we'll see you back in February.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. Much appreciated.
Yeah, thank you. We'll bring you to the grand opening.
Right. Well, I'll jump in the river, so that'll be great.
Perfect.
Common sense provided.
All right, we've got two more projects to deal with. Let's take a 8-minute break. I've got 10:57 on my clock, so let's start up again back at 11:05, and we'll get through those two projects. And so have a break, and we'll see you in a second. Again, I see faces, enough faces for us to get going again, so we will get started with our next project, which is the town of Lyman. And this looks pretty straightforward. I'll turn the time over to Candace for a quick briefing here.
Number 6 on the agenda today is the town of Lyman for a new Caterpillar excavator and trailer. The request is for a $78,000 grant. The funding median range does suggest a loan, but it changes with interest rates for minimum, median, and maximum. This project consists of the purchase of a new Caterpillar. They've described the type that they're going to get. This is used at the cemetery, if I understand correctly. The remaining plots are getting kind of close together, and it's difficult to dig between them, so a mini excavator could get in between those tighter spaces. And that is what this request is.
All right. We have some folks on from Lyman. You want to introduce yourselves? Come off of mute first. I see that they're here, but.
Here we go. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yep.
This is Bryson Syme, town council member over the project with Mayor Alden Van Dyke here. Just some comments on this project. We hire a guy to come and dig our grave plots for us with his backhoe, and he's expressed concern about the tight spots and running over the headstones or other plot areas, and this mini excavator would help us cut that cost of hiring him, or he's expressed a desire not to do it anymore. Also, it would help in our expansion of the cemetery. The remaining plots are getting minimal, and there's some expansion work that needs to be done.
Okay. Let's go to the board with any questions. Mr. Zanotti.
My comment is, Mr. Chairman, the dead people have paid their dues. There's no money from them to collect, so we need to consider that as a Christmas time. Maybe on the point of lesser interest, as the Commissioner Ogden says, we're in the 0.5 interest, so be generous.
Do you have a motion to suggest?
I will say 78,000.5, 10 years.
So a $78,000 loan, 10 years at 0.5%.
That would be my suggestion, please.
Second.
Stevens, I'll second it.
Okay, so a motion made by Mr. Zanotti, seconded by Commissioner Dalton, to approve a $78,000 loan, 10 years at 0.5%. Further discussion, Mr. Galecki.
Well, I had a couple of comments. With that being said, I guess one to the applicant, it's that, you know, if Lyman is small enough, one, if you have to go for a loan, you know, a $12,000 trailer, you may not need a trailer or get a used one if you don't have to use it much.
I was just going to say, yes, that has been in our consideration. When we got estimate prices, those were for new equipment, but the board's understanding and town residents that if a used one is an option, we would definitely go that route. We're not expecting new. That was just the bid price that we were looking at.
Then my next question, which I was thinking, is that, you know, like last year in 2019, we gave you $57,000, almost $58,000 for a dump truck and, you know, purchase a truck and, you know, some equipment. My thought is, if you're going to get a loan, you want more money get more like a $100,000 loan half percent, it's good. You're not going to get better interest rates than that for a loan. Are there more equipment you had needs for if you had to take a loan? Are there more equipment you could buy? I guess is the question.
We have discussed an upgrade to the lawnmower for the town park area and the cemetery itself. Further down the line, I mean, it's good working condition now. And, you know, we try to make do and make our expenses minimal, but that has been in the discussion.
So if there's a motion on the table for $78,000 at a 0.5% for 10 years, would you want $100,000 at a 0.5% for, you know, 10 or 15 years?
It's definitely something to look into. We wouldn't be opposed to exploring that option.
Okay. I'll wait for other comments. Thank you.
Okay, go to Commissioner Lytle.
So, coming from a pretty small town and knowing that it's hard to get everything to work right, just a few questions that I've got. I'm assuming there's other needs than just the cemetery for the mini excavator. Is that true?
Yes, it would help, you know, with water repairs around the town hall and the park area, other little maintenance projects that arise, yes.
That you're currently contracting to other people?
Yes.
Okay. Did you guys explore purchasing it traditionally, using a bank or somebody? and getting a loan for it prior to or in conjunction with looking at CIB?
We did not.
Okay. Is the that answers my questions. Thank you.
Okay, seeing no further questions, we'll place this motion. Again, the motion is to approve a $78,000 loan, 10 years at 0.5%. Roll call vote for this, Pam.
Mr. Chairman, before you go, should we ask Mayor to see if you want to consider $100,000, like Greg suggested, if he needs some more money for the other equipment or no?
Well, personally, let's come back in the February funding meeting if he has other needs and we can discuss that. But without a clearly defined scope of work, a little uncomfortable with that.
I got it. Thank you.
Pam, go ahead.
Okay. Treasurer Damshin?
Yes.
Mr. Galecki?
Aye.
Commissioner Ogden?
Aye.
Commissioner Lytle?
Aye.
Mayor Baker?
Aye.
Mr. Stevens?
Yes.
Commissioner Dalton?
Yes.
Commissioner Hansen?
Yes.
Commissioner Adams?
Yes.
And Mr. Zanotti?
Aye.
Thank you. All votes in the affirmative.
Okay, that's on the priority list for the February funding meeting. If you do have other, equipment needs, you want to bring that up to $100,000 or somewhere around there, I think that's something the board would be happy to talk to you about in February.
Okay. Well, we appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Last project on the agenda is in our major infrastructure application. Turn the time over to Candace for a brief description on this.
The number five on the large infrastructure applications is King County Municipal Building Authority. This is for an East Zion Visitor Center building and landscaping. The request is a $15,550,000 loan, 30 years at 1%. This project is in Kane County. This project consists of constructing an 8,000 square foot visitor center on the entrance of Zion National Park. It's my understanding that nothing right now exists that could be considered an actual visitor center. The project is ambitious, but it's going to do a lot of extra things, as you can read in the description. There's been a lot of discussion back and forth about this application. They did submit an application for the East Zion Visitor Center back in October. They had to go through some different ideas and iterations because at that time it had some components that perhaps would not be eligible for CIB funding. I believe the application is now ready for board review. The application is a very a beautiful facility. The notice type on the Utah Public Notice website indicated only a meeting. I'm hoping that they did have a public meeting, a public hearing. The public notice must state the nature of the meeting, and that was one of the issues at the original application. I believe they've accommodated that in quite a magnificent way. This is a project that will probably facilitate an expansion of the area, and it will probably take some of the heat off of the other Zion National Park. So this is in Kane County. So with that, there's a lot of information. They say that the groundbreaking is planned for late 2020. I think we missed that window, but that was in the original application. So if they could say what the time frame for this project is, that would be helpful. And I will let the board discuss.
Okay, I think half of our panelists queue are people representing this project, so I'll let them sort out who's saying what and introduce themselves.
Hi, my name is Brent Chamberlain. I'm the King County Commissioner. I'm also the chair of the King County Municipal Building Authority. We have one other that I would hope will have an opportunity to speak. That is Jeff Bradybaugh, who is the Zion National Park Superintendent, and he would have some comments to make for this purpose. I'm going to make some comments. Certainly, yes, we did have a public hearing that met all of the requirements. And also, we would be looking at about a one-year build after we start. We've got some engineering and design work to do yet, some final engineering. So after that was completed, it would be about a one-year build on this project. It's a fairly substantial project. The project is part of one of the greatest public entity partnerships in the state of Utah and has been described by Lieutenant Governor Cox as one of the key tourism growth areas in the state. In and of itself, it creates no economic development, but rather organizes a stream of people entering and exiting the park, dispersing knowledge and generally smoothing out the customer experience of the park patrons. In the enabling legislation controlling CIB funding, it states that CIB funds should be used for the benefit of the greatest number of citizens of the state. And this project does that. It has the capacity to impact about one-third of the population of the state of Utah on an annual basis based on existing traffic flows. The East Zion Visitor Center will be located on State Road Highway 9, about 10 miles east of Mount Carmel Junction and about a mile and a half east of the East Park entrance. It's on the northwest corner of North Fork Road and Highway 9 intersection. Interesting to note, Zion National Park is the fourth most visited national park in the country and is tremendous economic driver for the state of Utah, creating between $500 million and $1 billion each year for the state of Utah. About 4.5 million people enter and exit this park, most often going to other national parks or visiting other, more of the incredible beauty and scenery and recreation areas throughout the state of Utah. So as the people come in, they exit. This is the keystone that gets people coming to the state, and then they oftentimes spend time visiting the other parks, state and national parks. 4 or 5 years ago, pressure from the crowds caused National Park Service to start to work on a project of developing a visitor management plan to control the flow of persons in the park. Options included requiring reservations and other management practices that effectively would limit the overall number of people able to visit the park. That could have a substantial negative impact on the state of Utah and the surrounding counties. And so King County and the other surrounding counties have worked diligently with the park, and we really appreciate their effort in working with us to try to find solutions to help them to accommodate the visitation that they have without reducing that. Currently, over 1 million people a year enter the park from the east side. And many of those, we don't have a head count yet on the number exiting the park, but that's being worked on through Dixie State University. But the ones exiting the park on the east side are bound for other areas in Utah nearly all of the time, and they have no opportunity to interact with somebody to give them the directions of where to go and really encourage them to spend more time in this great state. So a visitor center would make a great deal of difference to visitors that are exiting that direction and to help improve the economy throughout the state. Again, this is not an economic development project for King County by itself, but it will have a tremendous impact on the state of Utah. This partnership includes King County, the Bureau of Land Management, the National Park Service, Zion National Park, and there's a private component which owns the land, and so it's an amazing partnership. It's been in the works for a number of years, and the private landowner has had a vision from the very beginning to not duplicate the uncontrolled Salt Lake State Street type growth and development that we often see at the entrances of these parks. In order to prevent that from occurring and make this a more enjoyable experience for the visitors, the government needs to step in. It's going to take a government entity to build a visitor center. And for reasons which I can explain, that's not going to happen by the National Park Service that doesn't have the funds, nor does it have the available land inside the park. All of the east side of the park is currently wilderness and would be very difficult to build in. So therefore, it's not usable land. The National Park Service does plan on, though, by adopting, or by this park being developed on the east side of the park, on land that will be donated by the private entity to King County. They will provide staff to staff this visitor center. They will use their symbol, the National Park symbol, on the exterior of the building. And they will provide education and teaching about the area and park-like things that they do at other visitor centers. This is in addition to the personnel that King County and others will provide there. UDOT has agreed to make some modifications to the flow of traffic at this location by adding a roundabout, which will smooth out and slow the traffic flow so that this beautiful building can attract and stop people to visit. Again, as mentioned, there's no economic development opportunity created for the county in building the visitor center, but without doing so, the county loses the opportunity to help control the flow of over a million people per year that pass in front of this location. It will help provide services, information, and educational opportunities for these visitors. As I mentioned, the private landowner is willing to donate about 18.6 acres of prime land. By the way, that's been estimated or been appraised to be worth about $1.6 million. To King County. King County will use that, or will build on that land if we secure funding, about an 8,000 square foot visitor center, 6,000 square foot administrative building. There's a couple of thousand feet for restrooms, and there's numerous areas, sunshades, awnings, and areas that are designed specifically for programs and teaching locations, information kiosks, and the other things that would allow this to be a park-like experience for the visitors. The funding request is $15,550,000, has been mentioned, for a 30-year term, and we had indicated a 1% interest rate. Didn't request any grants because we didn't know if any was available, but certainly we'd be happy to talk about options that might be available. An RDA is being established to capture the incremental tax revenue. Repayment of the loan will come from both county budgeting modifications and also from incremental tax revenue. The county's financial advisor, Zion Bank, has projected there will be sufficient tax revenue to repay this loan in full. King County has always been the land of beauty, but less so when considering economic opportunity. It's been mentioned before some of these small counties have a lot of public land. In nearly 90% of King County landmass is controlled by the federal and state government. And so we miss out on the opportunity for taxation of this. So it puts us in a very difficult situation. Beyond that, the federal land has locked up most of the millions of tons of coal and other mineral development that would normally be available. But King County is now a federal producing, mineral producing county. And that will continue to grow. One of our main usable resources, however, is the people. The natural beauty attracts people from throughout the state and is probably one of the most used resources for the population of the state. We've seen this during coronavirus where visitation has peaked with people trying to get to these remote areas and areas that can provide solitude. One thing that I should have mentioned previously is we will be asking, because the funding source of this will grow over time, we will be asking for a two-year deferral of loan payment, understanding that the interest payment will continue to accrue, but we will need a little bit of assistance to get the fund build up enough to be able to handle the debt service. The East Zion Visitor Center will be a huge benefit to the citizens of the state of Utah. We ask for your support on this project. I'm available to answer any questions, and at some point here, whether now is the best time for Superintendent Brady Barr, if you want to ask questions, and we could bring him on later, but it is important to hear what it means to the Zion National Park.
Yeah, I think we want to hear from Mr. Brady Barr right now, if you want to make some comments.
Thanks so much. Good morning, everyone. I think Commissioner Chamberlain's summary encapsulated many of the things that we're thinking about and seeing as opportunities with this visitor center. Just a year ago, we were celebrating the 100th anniversary of Zion National Park. And as Commissioner Chamberlain mentioned, it's one of the most visited national parks in the national park system. This entrance to the park, the east entrance, is very busy, as Commissioner Chamberlain pointed out. And we prefer and try to orient our visitors as they come to the park, provide services such as backcountry permits and those sorts of things in an efficient manner. Right now, we have a visitor center in Zion Canyon and a small facility at Co-op Canyons. Yet the east entrance is one of the most visited entrances, and we have no facility there. It's important that we have an opportunity to orient visitors to provide those services. It enhances their visit. It provides an opportunity for us to communicate safety messages and other things that are happening in the park, and provide what we call interpretation, education about the resource as the visitor is preparing to experience that resource, utilize the hiking trails, take the scenic drives, and those sorts of activities that they'll engage in the park. The need for a visitor center at the east entrance has been identified in numerous management plans over the years. I can go back into the 50s and actually point to those needs. But our most recent general management plan in 2001 explored the option inside the east boundary of the park, but we simply didn't have the terrain or the available water supply to develop a visitor center inside the park boundary. So discussions have continued since that point with various partners on the east side of the park about the potential for a facility outside the park. And so, again, with a multitude of partners, as Commissioner Chamberlain mentioned, this opportunity is coming to fruition. Be happy also to answer any questions.
Got several hands up, so we'll start with Treasurer Damption.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to verify that we had looked at the prior meeting content and the degree to which it complied or didn't comply with requirements. And I think Commissioner Chamberlain suggested that, or actually Candace suggested that that has been addressed already. I just want to confirm that. I know that we had taken a look at that previously. That had been an issue. It sounds like that has been resolved. I just wanted to confirm that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
From my perspective, I can answer that this private landowner had some anticipation of some some private development in the area, and that certainly is not part of this project at all. It's not included in the land that will be donated by this by the landowner to King County, and so it has nothing to do with the project or the CIB request. Anything else that goes on there?
All right, let's go to Mr. Zanotti.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This project is the answer to my prayers. 30 years ago, I came to beautiful state of Utah. And in the first week, I decided to give me 2 weeks vacation as a birthday present and travel through the Mighty Five. They didn't call it Mighty Five back then, but when I got to the Zion National Park, I saw that the awe and beauty. But unfortunately and stupidly, nobody had told me you don't travel to national parks during the holiday season. When I got there, I circled 15 times to get one parking spot in Zion National Park. It was really disappointing, but then I decided, okay, I'll go to Bryce and other places and then come back to it. On the way out, I noticed this vast, beautiful land just sitting there on the other side of the Zion National Park. And even then, I decided, why in the world anybody hasn't thought to put another visitor center in this section? Because it has a beautiful setting. They have many other trails that I used and enjoyed. They didn't have the congestion of that part of the Zion National Park. And I thought, I need to talk to someone about that. Ever since, I've been lobbying for this thing with the previous commissioner of the King County, with the Governor Leavitt, Governor Huntsman, Governor Herbert, and of course, when I got lucky to get in the UDOT, I even cut the door ears that, hey, we need to have some kind of improvements there for the people to come back and enjoy. And now that we're coming to the point that some brave enough people from the commission of the King coming forward, finally. And of course, they have opportunity, and we had a generous landowner, which I met personally. Thank you for that. Now we had an opportunity to do this. The day that I went to the park, of course, 30 years ago, it was only 1.1 million visitors. I'm sure that Superintendent Brady Bach can verify that, but before COVID, the projection was 5.1 million visitors to the Zion National Park. So we're trying to do some improvements by way of that UDOT working with the superintendent, trying to get the transit system in place and update their transit system. But this is a worthy project. It is just the one thing that we need to consider seriously. And I have my 100% my heart and my support to every one of you guys in the commission. Please support this. But I have three questions, Mr. Chairman, I would love to ask, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So ownership and management of the facilities, Commissioner Chamberlain, who's going to be in charge of that? And what was or is Governor-elect's response to your, request lately? Is he going to be helping you with any kind of support financially? And have you had any kind of communication with the State Office of Tourism to help you? So please answer all those questions.
Okay, first of all, it makes no sense for a private individual to build a visitor center because there's no revenue stream. It has to be done by a government entity. King County will own and operate, be responsible for the operation of this visitor center, certainly throughout the duration. The landowner intends that this land always has to maintain a visitor center on it, or it would revert back to the private landowner. And so, yes, we will own the land, we will operate, or be responsible for the operation of the visitor center and the things that are there. Secondly, when Mr. Cox, Governor-elect Mr. Cox was down, he was very impressed with this. He made some statements about how important this is to the state of Utah that we make this happen, and his full support. We are currently working on some things. There's more to this project than the visitor center that we're asking CIB for. That includes trails. We're going to be building initially 15 miles of trails, King County will, outside of the park, starting around this visitor center. That, again, is a tremendous collaboration between private and public. Obviously, it takes cooperation of the Bureau of Land Management, private entities where the trailheads will start to dedicate those, and even Zion National Park, because at least one of these trails will go back into the park. With a maximum, right now we currently intend on building up to about 42 miles of trails. So we will have parks that will, or trails that will rival anything in Zion National Park to help take some of that pressure off the park, the visitation off the park that is, honestly, and some trails are a bit overloved, perhaps, and we can help that situation. The third question, Vicki Varela, the State Director of Tourism, has been here. She declared that this was the most important destination development project in the state of Utah and had 100% of her full support behind it. So this really is a project for the state of Utah. I mean, King County will do it. We'll be responsible for it. We need your assistance to make it happen. Obviously, it cannot happen. But this, more than anything that I have seen, this is a benefit to the state of Utah. And so we certainly are asking for your support here. Did that answer your questions?
Yes, thank you. And you have my support, Commissioner, and I'm ready whenever you want me to. And, of course, I will wait for Chairman's signal to give even motion for that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go to Commissioner Adams.
Sorry, I needed to get unmuted. Thank you. I, like Zanotti, am very supportive of this project. I'm not going to enumerate all the reasons why. I've talked to the Kane County commissioners and other people in the area. Like what's going on, I'm going to encourage Nagy to make a motion for 100% loan at 0.5% for 30 years or 1% for 30 years. I'm sorry. Which is something I think they've asked for and they said they can live with. And so, Nagy, when you make the motion, I'm already on board for a second.
All right. So moved. We wait to hear the comments first, Commissioner Adams, please.
I don't think we should proceed, Mr. Chair, without first knowing how Nagy really feels about this project.
Let me get through Mr. Stevens and Commissioner Hansen, and we'll circle back to Mr. Zanotti here. Mr. Stevens, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I noticed that your public hearing minutes, you had a rather robust public hearing, and I compliment you for the thoroughness of the information that's contained there. You may have touched on this, and or the superintendent may have, but I didn't pick up on it, and that was there was a question raised during the public hearing about staffing the visitor center. Who will and how will that be arranged for?
So Zion National Park will provide staffing for this and do the same things that they do at other visitor center. Zion Forever will have some staffing there to help because they run a number of youth programs in Zion National Park right now. They do a lot of the training, the Junior Ranger program, et cetera. So this park, the visitor center is designed to allow for that, to have plenty of space for that. And King County will be responsible for providing staffing there as well. There'll be a space there for the Bureau of Land Management to have staffing there. So this is really a multi-agency information providing facility. And so, but in the end, of course, King County is responsible for staffing this in collaboration and cooperation with Zion National Park.
Thank you for that explanation.
Let's go, Commissioner Hansen.
Again, hats off for a great project and extremely unique. Because you have such a great opportunity when this is done to do education and knowledge base, extending knowledge out to folks that come and visit, you know, I hope that it could be something where we could help visitors understand that Utah is a beautiful, wonderful, diverse state, and it's because of natural resource production in the state of Utah that the visitor center was able to be built, and that we can have both beautiful, amazing, pristine areas in the state of Utah and also areas that are perfect for natural resource production that makes mineral lease money available for these kinds of projects. And having said that, you have my full support.
Thank you, Commissioner. Okay, let's circle back to Mr. Zanotti.
Well, Mr. Chairman, with support from my dear colleague, Commissioner Adams, and Commissioner Chamberlain is ready to support us too. I would like to suggest their own request, the whole 100% loan, 1% interest, 3 years, 2 years deferred payment.
Second.
Okay, so a motion made by Mr. Zanotti, seconded by Commissioner Adams, is to approve a $15,550,000 loan, 30 years at 1% with a 2-year deferral. Any further discussion to that motion?
Pardon me, but when you have a deferral, you still pay interest.
Yes.
Yes, they know. I hope they do.
We understand that.
Okay.
If not, kind of send it to me. I'll pay the first.
Further discussion of the motion, we'll go to Mr. Galecki.
Hey, I just want to acknowledge on the project that, you know, they did things like renewables. They use geothermal for their, you know, for heating and such. I don't know if it was cost effective or not, but I think it's a great idea. I just want to point that out.
Great. Thank you. And Commissioner Ogden.
Yeah, I just want to make one comment. Now, this has all come out of the bonus fund. We don't have to take this out of our lease revenue fund, correct?
Well, so the applications and the major infrastructure set aside at the February meeting, we can do some transfers if we need to put bonus money into that, or, you know, figure that out at the February funding meeting. So we can talk more about the funding source. Right now, we'll just put the project onto the priority list.
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
and just a heads up, Mr. Chairman, that from the UDOT, we are ready to get the roundabout whenever Commissioner and all the commissioners from, and then everybody's ready to give us the money to do it.
Okay. See no further discussion. We'll place that motion for a vote. Pam, roll call, please.
Treasurer Damshin.
This is a great project. Happy to vote yes.
Mr. Galecki.
Aye.
Commissioner Ogden.
Fully support the project, yes.
Commissioner Lytle.
Yes.
Mayor Baker.
Mayor Baker, are you present to vote? I'll come back to him.
Yes.
Sorry. Oh, okay, there we go.
Thank you. Mr. Stevens.
Yes.
Commissioner Dalton.
100% in favor, yes.
Commissioner Hansen.
Yes.
Commissioner Adams.
Yes.
Mr. Zanotti.
Hallelujah, yes.
A rousing 100% affirmative.
Thank you. That's it's exciting. We're excited about it. It's on the priority list for the February funding meeting. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chairman, and all of the board members. We really appreciate your support on this. You'll be proud of it. We look forward to inviting you to a grand opening.
It's good.
We'll all be there.
All right.
Okay, that brings us to item 9 on our agenda, 9.2, to consider a motion to close the session pursuant to Utah Code 524-205-1C. Is there a motion?
Jonathan, I have a board issue.
Let's go to Commissioner Adams. What was that?
I have a board issue I'd like to discuss.
Okay.
Do you want to wait till after the?
Well, we can do it right now. We're at board member discussion, so.
Okay. I'm not really sure how to approach this other than just to be offensive. So I'm going to take my best David Damshin shot at what I want to discuss. I'm just kidding, David. I belong to the Southeastern Utah AOG. The Southeastern Utah AOG is housed in an old school building that is over 50 years old. That AOG building has had sewer leaks that has caused the floor to shift. We haven't been able to determine whether it's the floor joist, the foundation, or what. We have continual air conditioning, heating issues because the air conditioning heating system is so old. Also housed in that building is the business and technical center. Outside in the parking lot is the food bank. Parking lot is where the old playground was for the school. When the parking lot was paved, apparently whoever did that, whether it was Price City or the AOG or whoever, didn't put sufficient material underneath the asphalt, and Nagy can tell you what happens to asphalt when it doesn't have sufficient support underneath it. In about September of this year, the board started discussing what are we going to do with this building and with the AOG, a place for the AOG to meet. We put in a new security system in the building that had individual locks on the doors because we'd had some vandalism and some theft of some sensitive data. One of the issues we deal with now is that the Business and Technology Center will put a brick in the door after hours so that they can get into the building and get out. Again, that has created more security problems. As an AOG, we include four counties. Emory, Carbon, Grand, and San Juan. CIB staff, I'm sure, knows what it takes to try and run an AOG or have some sense of it, since CIB funds help fund a planner in that area. So we began discussions as the AOG board about several options that we had. And we had, you know, we had a lease renewal coming up with the city of Price, who owns the building. We were reluctant to commit a lot of funds to try and repair this building, because simply it's a 50-year-old building. We looked at other buildings and other, even over in Emory County. And to make a long story short, Carbon County Commissioners came up with a land option that they were willing to donate to the AOG if they wanted to try and build a new building. Now, before I go any further, I just want you to know what an amazing AOG director we have in Jerry Gamber. I think this lady works harder than Nadi Zanagi. She puts in about 95 hours a week at her job and gets paid for 40. She is awesome. She's a little bit frustrated right now because of all of the complications we have with our physical facility. I told her I would try and articulately explain what we're up against with the AOG. We've had some some engineers look at possibility what a new building would cost and what it would take. We have been in discussions with Keith Heaton in October and November about the possibility. And I think Keith has probably made some of the staff at the CIB aware that these discussions were going on. At least that's what I'm being led to believe. So we encourage Jerry to submit an application, a large infrastructure application for a new building that would go on this donated land by the generous Carbon County Commissioners. And without a continuing lease in place, with all the mechanical problems, with the foundation problems, with everything that was going on, we as an AOG board decided that this could probably qualify as an emergency application and be on the board agenda before the building season of 2021 started. So the application was submitted. The AOG staff was told did not qualify as an emergency application because of some of the audit changes we had made. The CIB board had made in November. It looks like staff decision was that it was an emergency and it wasn't eligible to be placed on the agenda until July of 2021. This was disappointing to me and the other board members of the AOG, because of the amount of effort that had been put into trying to get this project on the agenda so that it could be possibly funded and addressed in the 2021 construction season. I'm a little bit at a loss as to what we should do. I mean, it's kind of feel like somebody that lives in Salt Lake and I'm going to go camping down in San Juan County and all I've got is a tent. And I've got to go down there or I got to go down by the Green River and put up my tent and watch Jonathan jump in the water or something.
let me just jump in and see if Keith and Candace want to comment on this. So
yeah,
I've not been made aware.
appreciate your comments, Commissioner. And I agree that, Jerry and her staff do a great job. And we are always very supportive of the work they do. And as you know, we work very closely with them on all of the projects in your region and all the regions for that matter. I think a couple points to clarify here. It's correct that I had been in conversations with staff, Jerry in particular, for the last 6 weeks or so. The initial conversations that we had were to the effect that they were trying to work out repairs to the existing building and there were issues with ownership. Even though the AOG is the primary resident there, apparently the building is owned by the city and they were trying to work through issues with that. And I expressed our full support of the AOG, the work that is done there, and anything that we can do to help out. Then just last week, following several weeks without any conversations, it seems that through our administrative assistant, we received notification that they were intending to make an emergency application to purchase a new building or make repairs. It really wasn't clear. So Candace immediately responded to Jerry about our processes. We had a few email exchanges, and then Candace and I had a phone call just a few days ago with Jerry's staff, Michael Bryant, the regional planner, and Jade Powell, who's their strategic planner. And what we expressed to them is, given the nature of this project, that it's new construction, we didn't see the justification as it being an emergency. We didn't have the project on the capital improvement list, or what we now call the CIB application list. We had not received an application, and to this date, we still have not received an application. The talk that we were receiving up through the line of command was that they wanted to be on today's meeting, and this was just a few days ago. So, again, you know, if the building had washed away, we might have been able to make such arrangements, but, you know, we have public notice requirements. These agendas are set several weeks in advance. So we had a good conversation with staff. I came away from that conversation with the understanding that we had come to a mutual agreement that it would be in the best interest of the project if we put it on the CIB application list for next year. We're talking about the fiscal year, which begins July 1. Then they could come in immediately in July with a fully fleshed out project that had been through the proper process so that we didn't have undue scrutiny on what will be a very large and important project to everyone in the state, particularly those in Southeast. So what I seem to be hearing from you, Commissioner, is a little bit of a communication gap. Jerry was not on the phone call we had just a couple days ago, but I do trust that her staff conveyed the message. Candace had sent an email summary of the discussion, which I thought was very adequate. So I wanted to be very clear that staff does not make decisions about what applications come before the board. We work with each and every applicant to make sure they're putting their best foot forward, so to speak, that it's the best application that it can be. We do look out to protect the interests of the board and the fund to make sure things are done properly. We talk about this at almost every single board meeting, but we are not the gatekeepers. We don't tell people what they can and can't do. We work with them in partnership, particularly with you know, the AOGs, to make sure that the good projects are coming forward. So I think there's been a little bit of miscommunication here, and would love to work it out. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Board.
So may I suggest, Commissioner, we'd be happy to get on the horn with you and the AOG board and Jerry to continue to dialogue through this, figure out how to best proceed. I hear your concerns. It's a concern of mine. I've been in that building myself. And that was like 6 years ago, and it was in bad shape back then. So I totally get where you're coming from. I think we can probably, you know, figure out some better pathways or just make sure we're all on the same page. And I'll make sure Keith gets that set up, and we'd be happy to meet with the AOG board and Jerry at any time on this particular issue.
I really appreciate that, Jonathan. I think what Keith said, there has been a little bit of miscommunication. I was told that because the board had adopted some new rules, that the CIB list could not be amended midstream anymore. But part of the problem was that none of the planners were notified of this change you know, what the changes have been made at the AOG. I don't think we've even posted that kind of stuff on our website. So it really had AOG staff confused, because in the past we have been able to amend the CIB list, but if the board has made that change, we certainly need to notify all the applicants, at least put it on our website or our list of rules or our application. There's just so much going on right now with trying to change to meet the audit requirements and educate applicants, AOGs, counties, everybody to our process. This is such a needed project. I just hate to miss an entire construction season, which we know means higher prices and delays and possibly having to spend some of the really valuable money that the AOGs do have on repairs on a building that somebody else owns and is unwilling, you know, maybe to invest the kind of money that's needed to address the repairs. So, you know, I'm pretty frustrated with the whole situation. And so I think it would really do a lot of good if you, Jonathan, and whoever on your staff wants to meet with Southeastern Utah AOG and see if we can't resolve this problem.
Yep. Well, we'll reach out and get something set up as soon as possible.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay. Back to the motion. Commissioner, did you want to make that motion?
Did we go into closed session? I'll make that motion, and I assume it's a roll call.
Yeah. Motion in order. Is there a second?
Commissioner Ogden, second it.
Okay, a motion made by Commissioner Lytle, seconded by Commissioner Ogden. Enter closed session pursuant to Utah Code 524-205-1C. We'll do a roll call vote on that. Pam?
Treasurer Damschen?
Yes.
Greg Galecki?
Aye.
Commissioner Ogden?
Yes.
Commissioner Lytle?
Yes.
Mayor Baker? Mayor, are you still with us?
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Stevens?
Yes.
Commissioner Dalton?
Yes.
Commissioner Hansen?
Yes.
Commissioner Adams?
Yes.
And Mr. Zanotti?
Aye.
All in the affirmative.
Okay. And so we will invite you to log off of Zoom for now. You have a Google invite in your inbox for the closed session, and we will come back to the Zoom to finish up the open portion of the meeting. So you'll log off of Zoom and then join that Google meeting. Okay, let's see if we get a quorum back here. I'm here. Thank you, everybody, for joining us back into our open session. We have concluded the items on our agenda, so I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
Is Mayor Baker so moved?
Mayor Baker makes the motion to adjourn. We will do a voice vote on this. We have a quorum, so all in favor of adjourning, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? All right, we will be adjourned until our meeting in January. Thank you, everyone.
What about the lunch, Mr. Chairman?
Enjoy your lunch.
Also, Gail's last meeting.
We have a Christmas lunch. We have Christmas lunch by now. We get ready for it.
Yes, if you guys didn't know, Gail is retiring, and so.
Oh my goodness.
She's not a big retirement person, but she's gonna at least wave to us. So.
What will we do without you, Gail?
Yeah. What
will we do? We're gonna find out.
He's gonna enjoy.
Candace and Brenda.
Gail, congratulations. Enjoy, and don't be a stranger.
Thank you.
Please.
Thank you very much.
Yes. And thank you. Thank you very much for all your effort, Gail.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, everyone. Thank you.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. No COVID.
Yeah.
It took me a minute. I assume the motions have been made and we're all leaving.
Mayor Baker made at 1:15.
Okie doke.
All right.
Have a Merry Christmas, everybody that's still on the call.
Thanks, Jack.
All right. Thank you, Candace. You're muted, but thank you very much.
Well, then what I really meant to say was happy Kwanzaa. No, I'm just kidding. Merry Christmas.
Yeah, take care.
Okay, I'm going to end this meeting.
Thank you.
Are you?
You're welcome.